Good morning, everybody. Is there anything we need to know before we get started, Robin?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, this is the third report that the Judicial Department and the Public Defense Services Commission have made to the Emergency Board on the Application and Contribution Program.
Okay. Well, we'll start with number five then. And here they come.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Nancy Miller. I'm the Deputy State Court Administrator for Program Operations for the Oregon Judicial Department. And with me today is Ann Christian, former Director of the Indigent Defense Services Division and currently on contract with the Public Defense Services Commission, helping us implement this program that we're here to report to you about today. The Application Contribution Program implementation came from a budget note that you gave to the Judicial Department and Public Defense Services Commission last session. We have been working diligently to implement the program statewide since that time. And just to back up very briefly, what the program is about in essence is ensuring that people who are getting court-appointed counsel and having an ability to pay for court-appointed counsel are in fact assessed those costs. So there's a $20 application fee, and then through our indigent defense verification program, an assessment about whether or not the person can pay additional money toward the appointment of their counsel. So in terms of implementation, and we'll hit the high points because we know you have a very full agenda, and then be more than happy to respond to questions. We have 35 circuit courts which have implemented the application fee. The only one remaining is Curry, which will be on board by the 30th of this month. 32 circuit courts have fully implemented the application fee and contribution amounts in criminal cases. All 36 circuit courts will have fully implemented by March of 2005, including implementation in juvenile cases. We have had a few roadblocks in implementation of juvenile cases. There are some complicated ethical issues that we're working through, but we expect to have everybody on board by March 2005. 34 circuit courts are generating revenue from the application and contribution program, and the public defense caseloads in the two circuit courts that did not generate revenue last month, which were Curry and Wheeler, represent about 0.5% of the statewide public defense caseload. So it's a very small amount. We're in those counties where we're not generating revenue yet. The good news is that ACP has demonstrated sustainability over half of the court's verification staff, and the costs associated with operating the program are now other funded. We also anticipate transferring $400,000 to the general fund for the 0305 biennium. A couple of great byproducts of the implementation of ACP. There's really been a renewed emphasis on our verification program. We've done training across the state. We have a statewide application contribution coordinator who has just done a fabulous job, Lori Kroger. She's here today, working on the policies and the training. So it, in terms of its bang for the buck for the state, what we're really seeing here is what I said earlier. We're doing a better job at making sure that people who are eligible for counsel get it, people who can pay, pay it, and people who are not eligible don't get it. I think probably the biggest and most important thing from my perspective is that this really fits in with the legislature's direction, everybody's direction in terms of accountability for public dollars, and I'm hoping really builds people's faith in government. Those are the high points, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Questions? Representative Butler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It was estimated originally that this would generate up to $2 million for the general fund for the 0305. Are you telling us that we're going to generate only a total of $400,000 as a contribution back?
Chair, Representative Butler, yes.
And so we've got the glowing reports of the success of the program, only accomplishing about 20% of what it was supposed to do?
Madam Chair, Representative Butler, Here's the way I explain it. The projections that were made at the beginning were based on 16 pilots that had started, and as we implemented the program statewide, we really had to take a hard look at the consistency in the program, the policy decisions that we needed to make to implement statewide. So we made a couple of policy changes, and then as you implement statewide, you also see increased costs in terms of the forms that we need for verification, a couple of key things, and one more besides the forms.
There were some additional personnel expenses.
Right. So we're at $400,000.
Madam Chair, I'm concerned about that. I worked on the public safety sub when this issue came forward, and we anticipated a $2 million benefit to the general fund. To come forward now and tell us that that form costs and additional personnel are going to eat up all but a small portion of that, and that Curry and Wheeler counties are the counties that haven't come online, they won't bring us anywhere closer to the $2 million, I can assure you of that, at which point I'm a little bit suspect about how successful the program really is. Thank you.
Well, and I'm assuming that you're the ones who made the estimates.
Madam Co-Chair, members of the committee, and Christian, the estimates were made in May of 2003 and provided to Representative Patridge, and the projections were between $800,000 and, I believe, $2 million. So $2 million was the best-case scenario. In addition to what Nancy indicated, there was a greater delay in implementation with regard to application contribution in the counties that now have that. When we reported to this subcommittee in November, we anticipated, even then, Representative Butler, that we would have most of the counties implemented by the spring of 2004. There were a couple of legal issues that had to be addressed, one with regard to passage of the judgment bill last session. And that had a significant delay in implementation of the program. So to answer your question, part of the reduction in the projected additional revenue is the result of the delay in the implementation.
And also, Madam Chair, Representative Butler, another issue in the delay really related to the state that the circuit courts found themselves in at the beginning of the biennium. I think you're all aware of the devastating reductions that the Judicial Department took during the five special sessions. You were kind enough to restore our budget and our positions at the end of the session. Given that the session ran so late and we were down so low in staff, it took us a number of months to rehire those staff, ramp them back up again, train them. So between the judgments bill and the ramping up of the staff again, our regular circuit court staff, that also contributed to the delay.
Representative Miller?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Could you refresh me again as to what the eligibility requirement is?
I can, Madam Chair and Representative Miller. The eligibility standard is by statute, and I should have brought my statutes, but it's a situation the verifiers in the courts and the judges are charged with determining whether the individual applying for court-appointed counsel would have significant economic difficulties, substantial difficulties.
Substantial hardship or some
thank you. Thank
fluffy
you.
Language that
you remember from many times. So that's the statute. The issue is how to implement that on a daily basis. And there is a two-prong test. So the staff in the court first look at whether or not the individual applying for court-appointed counsel would qualify for food stamps. If the individual would qualify for food stamps, the assumption is that they qualify for court-appointed counsel. There are exceptions because sometimes assets that food stamps allow, we don't allow under verification. But in the majority of cases, if the person qualifies for food stamps, they qualify for court-appointed counsel. if a person doesn't qualify for food stamps, the second prong is whether or not the individual has sufficient resources to hire a lawyer. So the example I usually use is driving under the influence. If an individual is charged with driving under the influence, does not qualify for food stamps, there is a retainer rate that the verifier applies. For DUII, it's $500. That's rather low with regard to the cost of actually hiring counsel, but that's what we use in our guidelines. So if the individual has resources, that's income or assets, greater than $500 for a DUII, then the verifier would recommend the court deny counsel. And food stamp eligibility, I believe, is still 130% of poverty line.
Okay. Thank you.
Senator Messerly.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Maybe you covered this and I missed it, but what are you projecting now that you've got the counties or almost all the counties online? What are you projecting for the 0507 biennium of savings to the department?
Madam Chair, Senator Messerly, at this point, quite honestly, it's too early to tell. I'm not projecting that there would be significant revenue at this point, and Robin and I have talked about this, and Robin, I don't know if you can help any with it. At this point, I'm not sure that there would be revenue transfer in 0507. The intent was to try to transfer the general fund staff that we have now to the other funds. And until we see whether or not the revenue increases as the courts get more on board, I'm very hesitant to make an 0507 projection.
How far do you go in determining, I mean, a person fills out your form, I assume, how far do you go in checking to see whether they're hiding anything?
Madam Co-Chair, this is a critical issue with regard to the verification staff in the courts. Nancy alluded to the fact that during the budget crisis, many court staff were lost, if you will, and many of those were the verification staff. And we're seeing better verification now because those staff are back on board. The verifiers have a really significant manual and access to resources, bank accounts, credit accounts, employment division records. So verifiers look at the application from the individual. They make a recommendation to the court, for example, today, based on what is on the paper, I recommend, judge, that you appoint counsel. But then they check resources to determine whether or not individuals are being truthful. And if they discover a discrepancy, if you will, then they report that to the court, and court-appointed counsel is withdrawn, taken off the case.
And you're comfortable
that
the process is working that way?
Madam Co-Chair, I have not been directly involved for over a year with the verification program, but I believe that it's still functioning well, especially after the bringing back of staff.
And Madam Chair, I would say I think it's functioning, frankly, even better than it was before, given the training that we've been able to provide to staff across the state.
I'm just curious because you've brought in half of your lowest estimate. And even the fact that we got out of session late, and even the fact that we had to go in and hire some new people, it just seemed like it would have been higher than that. But.
Madam Chair, there was one policy decision, and I said there were some policy decisions. There was one policy decision that affected the revenue most significantly, and if you want me to frame that for you, I'd be happy to, because you could make some policy decisions to change that during the session if you want. There is a statute that talks about the distribution of security amount, bail, if you will. The statute sets priorities for how that security amount is distributed, child support, criminal fines, and assessment account. What was happening in the
in the early stages of the program, before we got this budget note and before we started the statewide implementation, is that some of the pilot courts were hooking into that security amount and using that security amount to apply as an asset for appointment of counsel. So when we took a look at the statutes for the statewide implementation, and having been involved in all of your discussions about the importance of the child support draw, the importance of the CAFA draw, I said, while a reasonable person could interpret this statute to allow the use of the security funds, there is a more specific statute that says child support first, CAFA next, not ACP first. So that significantly affected the revenue. If the legislature wanted to set a priority that ACP comes first and make that very clear in the statute, I would almost guarantee you that you would see a much higher revenue. But having been privy to all of your conversations about child support and CAFA, I just did not feel comfortable saying ACP came first.
Sure, some of those are federal legislative enacted items when it comes to CAFA and child support. We need to be very cautious in moving into that minefield.
Yeah, I think the child support may be ours, but you take it from one hand and pay it out in the other hand. So
that was exactly the issue.
Make any difference.
Rep. Senator Miller.
Is there any consequence to somebody who suggests they're eligible for counsel and they're determined not to be?
Madam Chair, Representative Miller, the information is reported to the court. We've been working closely with the district attorneys. The district attorneys can charge someone if they falsify the affidavit.
In addition, Co-Chair and Representative Miller, there are civil remedies. So there are both criminal and civil remedies, and they lose their court-appointed counsel.
Chair, I move we acknowledge the receipt of the report.
Okay, Representative Butler moves acknowledgement of the receipt of the report. Any objection? So ordered.
Thank you.
Thank you. A carrier. Well, I'll carry it. Go ahead. It's a report. How much more can I get in? Guess we'll find out. Yeah, I know. We'll find out.
Been together for a while.
Okay, the Racing Commission.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, you have in front of you item number 36. Is a request by the Racing Commission to increase their other funds expenditure limitation by $900,000 for expenditures related to development of parimutuel racing in Oregon. Currently, there is a parimutuel tax on hubs is the shorthand term for operations that take simulcast betting from around the country and that are housed in Oregon. Two-thirds of that revenue is to go to the development of the Oregon parimutuel racing industry, and one-third is to go into the general fund. This program has been very successful. The revenues have exceeded projections, and currently the commission's in front of you to ask for expenditure limitation to spend the two-thirds that's dedicated to development of racing in Oregon. You'll see in the analysis also we're projecting that this additional revenue will result in $1.3 million being transferred to the general fund beyond what was assumed in the commission's budget.
Just know something's making money. Good morning.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jody Hansen, and I'm the Executive Director of the Oregon Racing Commission. And I'm actually kind of excited to be here today because I think it's kind of a good, a positive message that this hub businesses that are in Oregon are doing well, despite other states having legislation for this type of wagering as well. They're choosing to stay in Oregon because of the business opportunity here with a consistent and fair regulatory body, and they like Oregon. And I also will say that we recently licensed one more hub, so we have a total of six now, and there may be others in the works. So on this positive note, I hope that it will continue, and that is why we're here to request an additional limitation for our expenditures.
Just one question. The two-thirds goes back to develop racing in Oregon. Can you just highlight at a high level, please, the beneficial uses of those resources, what they're being used for?
Madam Co-Chair, Representative Butler, the two-thirds of the hub is placed into a racing development fund, and that goes to supplement purses at county fairs throughout. There's five county fairs throughout rural parts of Oregon that have been very successful in also attracting tourism. And then we have supplemented safety improvements at some of the tracks in rural Oregon, and they have to contribute a 50% contribution, whether it be labor or materials, money. And that's been the primary use of that money.
Thank you.
Other questions?
Chair, I move that we approve the request as recommended by the Legislative Fiscal Office.
Okay. Representative Butler moves the LFO recommendation. Any objection? So ordered. Thank you.
Who would like to carry the good news?
Who wants to carry? See, when
sure.
Yeah, when there's money coming in, there's always a carrier.
You make the bad news.
Ah, you got a deal. All right.
You do the heavy lifting.
You've done more than your fair show.
That's the good news portion of our program.
The good news is.
We have the Secretary of State next. Good morning, Mr. Secretary.
Good morning, Madam Chair. Great pleasure to be here this morning, Madam Chair, members of the subcommittee. Do you want me to just go ahead, or do you want to talk a little bit first?
Actually, I haven't had a protocol. Staff usually jumps in before I get going, so if you have something that you'd like to
staff apologizes.
Don't apologize at all.
We had an early meeting, so we're not quite awake.
Not a really early meeting.
Not a really early. Not
yeah.
Early for him.
Yeah, I was going to say, that wasn't 4:30, yeah.
So staff was trying to wake up. Item number 7 for Secretary of State is a request for $3.2 million in federal funds limitation. It is to support the Help America Vote Act, and more specifically the Oregon Central Voter Registration Project that they are working on. The agency did appear before the Joint Legislative Information Management and Technology Committee a couple of days ago and received a favorable recommendation for the limitation increase. Just to let you know that this is a limitation increase. We do have federal funds in hand, and matching funds for this amount of money have already been allocated.
Okay.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Basically, the reason we need a $3.2 million federal funds limitation increase is because we're ahead of schedule, which is good news. What being ahead of schedule means is that we're going to be better prepared to meet the federal mandate on January 1st, 2006 to have a centralized voter registration system. In fact, we will meet that mandate. And what that means is that we're leading the nation in implementing centralized voter registration because we're one of the few states that's going to meet the mandate that's in the federal law for centralized voter registration. We had, as all of you I'm sure are aware, we had a few allegations of fraud last election with people voting more than one ballot. And the reality is that this centralized voter registration system prevents that kind of the possibility of that kind of fraud once the system is eliminated. People will only get every registered voter will only get one ballot. I also want to just brag for a minute about our contractor on centralized voter registration. Sabre Consulting is the company that we hired to do this, and they are an Oregon-based company. Their headquarters are a couple blocks from here. And once they got our contract, they were able to then successfully compete and be awarded contracts in the state of Missouri and the state of Mississippi. And what all that means is that a whole lot of federal money is coming and supporting Saber Consulting, which means it's supporting the Oregon economy. So just in real quick conclusion, we need this increase to complete centralized voter registration on time ahead of schedule.
Other questions? I have one. I did hear a lot of people during this last election, especially the closer we got to the election, the more of them I heard, saying, why don't we have a central voter system? Why isn't there one place you can go? Which I found interesting because I thought a lot of them were the same people who have been complaining that we didn't need one. but I'm curious. In my house, one of my sons had continued to be registered at home while he was going to college.
Right.
Graduated from college, moved into a home, and I said, you need to do something about your registration. So the day before the deadline, he went to the county clerk's office and re-registered.
Right.
And bless him, I got every single one of those pre-recorded phone calls because his ballot came to the house, and I burned the ballot. I figured Clatsop County is going to catch up with Washington County after the election.
Right.
So I wasn't concerned about that. But literally, Clatsop County sent a ballot to the house. Washington County sent him one, or gave him one, whichever the case may be. He voted there. How would that scenario have been different under this system?
Oh, it would be. That's a great question because it would, in fact, be completely different because you have one source of one registration list for the whole state, so that an individual voter who had been registered in one place, when they sought to re-register in a different place, their old registration is shifted to their new location. So there's only one voter. One voter that's going to get a ballot because it's a centralized list rather than a county by county list.
The old one is automatically canceled.
Right.
Okay. And then each county maintains their own portion of the list.
Each county remains the registrar of voters. So yes, they have responsibility to maintain their portion of the list.
If I were to re-register, say, in another precinct, or, well, to be another county, never mind. I guess it wouldn't. It could have been another precinct. Anyway, if I were to re-register, is it what happens if the county clerk, the elections department, is shorthanded? I mean, it's just automatic. As soon as they put it into their files, it's part of the main system.
Yeah, I can. Perhaps I'll finish that, Senator Dukes. Let's say that you moved today from Clatsop County to Columbia. What would happen would be you would fill out a new voter registration card in Columbia County. They would I'm John Lindback, Director of Elections in the Secretary of State's office. You'd fill out a new voter registration card in Columbia County. Columbia County would input Joan Dukes, and automatically built into the system is a duplicate check. Every time they input somebody's name as a new registered voter in their county, it automatically combs the voter records throughout the state, and possible duplicates will pop up. And your registration in Clatsop County will pop up. They'll see the same signature, and they'll say, oh, this voter has moved from Clatsop County to Columbia County. We're going to move that record over, and your record automatically shifts then from a Clatsop County voter to a Columbia County voter, and they don't have to phone back and forth. Your registration doesn't stay on the books and Clatsop for an undefined period of time so that you continue to get mailed ballots over there. All of that information will be coordinated and will catch up with the counties much more quickly under this scenario.
What happens if your signature is different?
Well, if your signature is different, they'll probably have to phone each other and say, we can't tell if this is the same voter or not, and you will not be registered until they're satisfied that you are one and the same person.
Or not.
Right.
Senator Messerly.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think that's long overdue. I've had constituents who have had students who have received three ballots and things like that. But I wanted to clarify for the record, Madam Chair, I thought I heard you say that you burned a ballot, and Mr. Secretary, isn't that a little illegal to burn somebody's ballot?
Oh.
Is it?
That way nobody can vote it.
I think there may be a legal problem with destroying someone else's ballot, but I think in those kinds of situations where you know that the person was mailed another ballot and it's a member of your family.
I checked with him first.
Right. we probably wouldn't get too excited about that situation.
Madam Chairman, seriously, what is the proper procedure? Send it back to the county?
Yeah, and inform the county that just in case that information hasn't caught up with them, return the ballot to the county, and they will automatically place that voter on their inactive voter list. Until they can confirm that the voter has registered in another county.
I'm not even sure I can find the class of county elections. They moved. Literally moved to a new building somewhere.
Well, Madam Chair, that brings up an issue at that particular point. Until that voter is deemed to be an inactive voter, then it counts against the 50-50 voting numbers that you've got in your county. So you need to get your son removed from the one.
Well, I figured because he registered the day before the deadline that there was no way that the county was going to have time to get all of that worked out and that it would happen afterwards.
Madam Chair, Representative Butler, that's another real benefit of the centralized voter registration system is that you're not going to have a whole lot of people registered in a couple of jurisdictions. Each voter is going to be registered in one jurisdiction, and that relates to the double majority requirements of Oregon law, really.
Mr. Co-Chair.
Do you foresee is the ultimate to be able to cross-check not only in Oregon but throughout the country? Because, I've got a daughter that's going to school in Arizona, and actually she's registered there, and I don't believe she received a ballot here, nor did I destroy it. But is that kind of the goal way out there? So that because it is pretty easy, I suspect, to go register in a number of states.
Sure. I know that's been an issue that they sort of didn't fully go into when they adopted Help America Vote Act, because they recognized states were really the registrar, or the counties were actually the registrar of voters. But
one of the Representative Miller, one of the original versions of the Help America Vote Act did have a provision in it that would require each state system to communicate with the others.
Right. Make people a little nervous.
And that got taken out, and I'm not sure what all the reasons for that, but it sounded to me like certainly a technical challenge.
Yeah.
How about practically in Oregon for someone creating a person to register? Suppose you were in a residence filled with real political advocates, and they create a name, and they all are agreeing that we'll use this address, and we'll just fill out a card and send it to you, and we've got ourselves another voter. Tell me if that's practical. Is that possible? What's the background check to make sure that a name that you receive is actually in existence?
Grover Miller.
Grover Miller.
No, Rover Miller.
Oh.
Representative Miller, is it possible? Yes, it's possible. What we have in election law in regards to that kind of scenario is what we have in a lot of sections of election laws, that we are dependent on somebody reporting to us that someone else is breaking the law in many respects. And that's true of any election system. No matter what election system you have, there's possible ways to defraud it. The question is, do you have adequate deterrence, voter information, and so on in place to try and deter that kind of activity? We actually had a voter in Lane County some years ago who was convinced that he could fool the system and do this, and Lane County caught him and he got prosecuted. And his argument was that he was just testing the system. It didn't work.
And like those guys that go through airport right. security saying,
right.
just want to see if I can get a bomb through.
Right. Right. And it, it's like a lot of parts of election law. We're dependent on the citizens of Oregon. If they obtain information that someone else is breaking the law, that they will complain to us.
Could there ever be a check where the actual individual is seen by a county clerk, and much the similar pattern as to a driver's license? Occasionally we have to show up and get that new mugshot or whatever we do, although that's become less frequent, I guess.
That's Representative Miller, that's a that kind of scenario has been a subject to debate in every state in the nation for many years about what is an appropriate level of requirement of identification in order to register to vote. And that always becomes a huge sort of political discussion in any legislature. And we've had those discussions here just since I've been here in 2001. We had it two sessions ago about whether or not if you want to register to vote in Oregon, you should provide some sort of proof of citizenship. What that usually ignites in the legislature is a debate between those people who believe that stringent requirements like that suppress voting versus folks who believe that it increases the integrity of the voting system. And I don't have the magic answer about either one of those, but I would not be at all surprised to see us revisit that issue next session in light of some of the voter registration issues that came up in this past election.
Like one more. Sure. You mentioned you had some allegations of fraud this last election. What stage in the process are these allegations? Are they being pursued?
Well, there was an allegation that I'm the one I'm specifically aware of was an allegation made at a press conference that six people had the opportunity to vote twice, and the allegation was correct in the sense that six people had received two ballots. Five of them did not vote twice, and one of them did vote twice and had been caught by Multnomah County 3 days before the press conference. So we really do have an excellent system to prevent that kind of fraud. And most, I'm happy to say, at least, five-sixths of the people in Oregon didn't seem to be interested in pursuing it, because it is a Class C felony to claim you haven't voted when you to vote twice is a Class C felony.
One final question, and then final question until I think of another question.
Okay.
Given your expertise in vote counting, how certain can people in Washington be that the current leader will be the leader a week from now?
The current
leader in number of votes, the final tally being 220 apart or something like that.
Would that be the one I heard announced this morning, or the one that was an hour after that?
60 votes.
I think this morning's will now be hand counted or something.
Yeah.
Right. Representative Miller, Madam Co-Chair, I actually, the election staff has a meeting every morning, and I walked into it this morning and said, all of us should just be very thankful that we are not the state of Washington. Because anytime you have an incredibly close election, we saw it 4 years ago in Oregon in terms of 6,000 votes between Al Gore and George Bush, and it took a long time to finally declare the outcome. And, 3 million votes, and the difference is what? Sometimes it's 60, sometimes it's 200. All I can say is it just creates a huge challenge for the election staff to.
Are you going to give me odds? Or?
No, I'm not. I have no idea.
Sorry. Actually, they have until tomorrow to certify those. And Grays Harbor County was automatically recounting because they had a computer malfunction during that. So I don't know that what we heard this morning is even going to be the final official. I have a city council race in my district that is currently separated by one vote.
Oh.
Yeah. But I was curious, John, when we were doing county fairs and trying to register people, somebody started talking about identification. So actually somebody did lead me to the elections division in the most circuitous route, but I did find them long enough to find out there are identification requirements.
Yes.
So that if you were to register today, depending upon how you registered, you may have to show identification. Could you explain those?
Under the Federal Help America Vote Act, the federal law requires us to ask voters who register to vote through the mail for a piece of identification that shows their address. It doesn't have to be picture ID. A lot of people think it needs to be picture ID. But they're required
to show the address?
Mm-hmm. Address and name. That provision, of course, was a sort of huge example of what I was talking about earlier. It became a huge fight in Congress between the forces that vote that kind of thing suppresses voter registration and folks that say they wanted to boost the integrity of the voter registration system. That requirement is there for us to ask for that ID.
The people we were registering at the county fair, there was no check done.
That's right, because they aren't registering through the mail. They're registering in person. And the way it was explained to us, by congressional staff, and this is an example of how this whole issue becomes sort of so hot. The way that it was explained to us by congressional staff when the bill first passed was, this does not apply to voter registration drives. All they want to know is that you're not dead or a dog. And if you're not standing in front of them, and if you're standing in front of them registering at the table, they know that you're not dead, and they know that you're not a dog.
But they also don't know that you're John Smith.
Well, but they didn't get quite that far
okay.
in the legislature.
Okay.
And that's...
And so what you're after?
One question for
yes,
Representative, Madam Chair. I just wanted to make certain that Monica was satisfied that the payments to Sabre Consulting and the other utilization of the $3.2 million is appropriate under the federal guidelines for the HAVA.
Madam Co-Chair and Representative Butler, I did not do an extensive audit of it, but I did review their expenditures to date and review, and it seemed consistent with their plan to go with the pilot projects and advance those payments sooner rather than later.
Madam Chair, having then received a favorable recommendation from the JLCIMT, I move that we approve the request.
Okay. Then Representative Butler's motion is to approve the request. Is there any objection? So ordered. Thank you for all that information. More than I really wanted, but thank you in one case. The carrier. I'll carry it. Number 8. Voters pamphlets.
Madam Chair and members of the subcommittee, as you may recall, the Secretary was before the Emergency Board in June to discuss funding of the 2004 general election voters pamphlet. At that time, the Emergency Board allocated $323,000 in general fund to get them started, get the ball rolling with printing and staffing to outline the pamphlet. At that time, they had noted they weren't sure how many measures were going to be on the ballot, nor did they know how many arguments were going to be filed by parties. You directed them to return when they knew the final costs. So they are now back. The pamphlet was out and distributed. It was in two volumes. Total cost is roughly around $900,000. So they're requesting the $390,000 from the reservation in the E-Fund and an additional, I believe they've modified the request down to $122,926 to cover the final costs of the voters pamphlet.
Mr. Secretary, no comment?
Basically, the good news here is that what we're asking for is $61,000 less than the actual cost because of savings we made in the primary voters pamphlet. And the numbers you just went through are the correct numbers, but they're $61,000 less than the actual cost. And the other good news is that despite the fact that we had two volumes of the voter's pamphlet, the cost of the voter's pamphlet was only 42 cents per voter. And that compares to a cost of close to a dollar per voter in the previous two presidential elections. So we've really managed to we've condensed. If you looked at the voter's pamphlet, you saw arguments condensed and all that. We've really managed to save money in publication of the voter's pamphlet. We also lucked out without having 26 measures on the ballot. So, but we're very pleased with the savings we were able to accomplish.
Okay. Representative Miller.
Is part of that statistic driven by a higher turnout? If you say it's measured by cost per voter, if your number of voters goes up, does that therefore reduce your cost?
Yes.
The other thing, what kind of feedback did you get from the public regarding print size and the way it was? You get any? Anybody say anything?
Not a thing. It was interesting. We, the staff person that's done the lion's share of the work on putting together the voter's pamphlet was very worried prior to us making these changes this year about us getting lots of calls, and we didn't get anything. We saved money, and the public seemed to think it was just fine. So.
That's good, and I just continue to urge you to do what I know you're going to do, and that is try to recoup more costs from those who submit those arguments. So I commend you for that position and wish you success.
Thank you, Representative Miller. And we will be reintroducing the bill to establish a fee system to pay for the voter's pamphlet in the next session.
Okay. So. Senator Messerly.
Madam Chair, Mr. Secretary, I can't pass this opportunity to clarify something that I've seen that is a concern to me, and that was there was a, can't remember which magazine, but there was a Oregon magazine, not a state of Oregon, but an Oregon magazine that had an article about your office and an obscene gesture from Uncle Sam. Was that, first of all, is it a hoax, or could you explain what was going on there?
All we knew about it was that the obscene gesture was placed there by the magazine, not there by us. We had nothing to do with that. And we don't really know anything about it. We complained to them, but, nothing we can do to, free speech and publication. They put that in there. We had nothing to do with it.
Verification. So there was no document from your office that had any kind of remarks or gestures like that?
No, absolutely not. No.
Okay. Thank you.
Good question.
I'm glad to hear that.
Right.
I want to get it on the record for your benefit, too.
Thank you.
Hey, other questions?
Madam Chair, just one quick item. I appreciate the Secretary mentioning that they will come back and examine the possibility of other funds next session to defray these general funds, but I just wanted to know if there are any other fund resources from within the Secretary of State's office which might be presently utilized to defray these kinds of general fund costs. Anything else that you can juice up to help us save this kind of resource, short of going back and asking for nearly $1,000 per page in the brochure, Mr. Secretary?
I think it's very accurate to say that where we are with general fund is that if we reduce general funds, we're talking about eliminating personnel. And so it's really, does the Elections Division continue to do its job, or do we lay someone off and pay for the voter's pamphlet? I mean, isn't that... Yeah.
I think Representative Butler, the question that we've been asked is whether or not federal Help America Vote Act funds could go towards the voter's pamphlet. What we're told is that with those funds that we're able to fund new efforts, but you can't take what you were doing before and just slide federal money into that and sort of backfill, as they call it. And so to the extent that we did a bunch of new stuff with the voters' pamphlets, made new initiatives or expanded it in some way, we could pay for that with Help America Vote Act funds. But if we're going to continue to do what we've done for a number of years here in Oregon, that would not be an option open to us.
finally, Madam Chair, I noticed that the recommendation of Legislative Fiscal Office is slightly different than that of the request, and I assume that that extra approximately $60,000 has been sorted out between Legislative Fiscal and the Secretary's office. With that, Madam Chair, I'd move that we go ahead and approve the recommendation from Legislative Fiscal Office.
All right. Representative Butler moves the LFO recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection? Thank you. Representative Miller. 44, the Liquor Control Commission. There's some reason we didn't go over this. Susie?
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. The Liquor Control Commission is here to request an increase in expenditure limitation to for agents' compensation resulting from an increase in liquor sales for the biennium.
Welcome.
Thank you. Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Teresa Kaiser, the Executive Director of the Oregon Liquor Control Commission. Yes, we're here with a very good story. Oregonians are purchasing liquor at higher rates than they have in the past, and we far exceeded our expectations on the projected sales. As a result of that, the compensation set aside for the agent's operating expenses will be exceeded, and for that reason we're before you to seek additional fund limitation so that they can continue to be paid at the rate originally set for them.
Madam Chair, just a couple of items. I didn't read it that they were purchasing a great deal more quantity as much as there was the higher priced products and other kinds of consumer preference issues. I think the overall increase appears to be between 7% and 8%. And I appreciate the fact that there's been some more aggressive marketing strategy by distillers, but I thought that was to deliver higher and more boutique kinds of products to the population. Recognizing we've got population increases, do you see a great deal more consumption of quantity of alcohol?
Madam Chair, Representative Butler, we're seeing both. We're seeing a shift towards a higher-end product. Apparently, folks are able to do that, believing I'm not going to have quantity, I'm going to have quality. But we also see an increase in the overall sales themselves. Could be part of population growth and demand. The bigger trend is toward the higher priced item. And I know our agents are very much motivated to steer customers towards higher priced items, and they do a very good job of that.
Some of that, I think, Madam Chair, is the demographics of Oregon, our aging and population as well, as not just population increase, but the aging of our population. So.
Other questions? No? That was a hand. Okay. Representative Miller.
You also have the opportunity to sell an additional day of the week. How many agents, what percent of the agents have the Sunday sales going, would you say?
Representative Miller, I believe it's about a third of our agents, about 88 of the 241 at the present time.
Does that make up some small piece of this increase? Or
I would estimate that it does. We don't have the ability to get daily sales figures, so I can't tell you with a certainty the dollar figures associated with that, but in our stores that are open on Sunday, they do quite a bit of business.
How did we ever estimate that increase?
Okay. Madam Chair, I believe that we could make that on the basis of what's happened in other states that expanded to Sunday sales. Some states are able to do daily sales figures, and national trends would indicate that Sunday sales are a volume increase.
Does the commission ever have a goal or expect to be able to track on a daily basis in the future? Is there some effort to do that?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, At one time in the past, we attempted to create a point-of-sale system, and it was not a successful enterprise. We have 241 individual operators, and to find one system that would meet all their needs is difficult. At the present time, we are looking at private sector companies that have point-of-sale systems in use already by some of our agents, and we're looking for the opportunity to expand that to other agents that maybe don't have that. We're also looking for private funds to do that.
Madam Chair, two things quickly. I first of all want to recognize the unsung heroes in this part of this process, and that is our agents. I know it's a number of agents here today, and I want to acknowledge them. And secondly, this is the first e-board meeting and issue of the Oregon Liquor Control Commission before the emergency board since the passing of one of the longtime stalwarts amongst the agents themselves, and that's Tiny Matthews. And I just wanted to, for the record, express my appreciation and recognition of the great work that Tiny did amongst the agents to try and move this process forward and make certain that that they were organized and working in a fashion which would benefit Oregon as well as the agents themselves. With that, Madam Chair, I move that we approve the request.
Representative Butler has moved approval of the LFO recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered.
I'd like to carry that.
All right.
Thank you.
Number 12, Department of Forestry.
Did they put these in here so that Susie wouldn't have to move? Is that what they did?
Okay. I was going to say I wanted to at least give me a smaller binder if we're going to flip all over
you're gonna,
the place.
You're going to go from 12 to 20, 34.
Let's just renumber them.
I figured there had to be a rhyme or reason. That would make sense.
Good morning, Chair Dukes, members of the committee.
I'm sorry. Susie, do you have a comment on this before? No?
Go right ahead.
Let me just introduce myself. I'm Clark Seeley. I'm the Associate State Forester for the Department of Forestry.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Tim Keith, the Assistant State Forester in charge of the Forest Protection Division.
Would you like to summarize, Susie, or...
I can. Madam Chair, members of the committee, this is a request from the Department of Forestry to allocate roughly $2.4 million from the special purpose appropriation to the emergency board to pay costs that are associated with severity fire suppression during the 2004 season. So go ahead.
This request is a follow to this past fire season. We shared with you back in the April session our concerns with the impending reduction of federal air tankers for the 2004 fire season. And as we described in our request to you, we took a number of actions through the course of the late spring and early summer to cover that fire suppression need. The special purpose appropriation that the legislature granted for use for this biennium was intended to cover such things as severe fire seasons, and we certainly needed to use that in both the 2003 and 2004 fire season. What we didn't know when you all met 2 years ago and granted the special purpose appropriation was that this significant change in the federal large air tanker program would occur, and it was fortunate for all of us that the appropriation was available and there, and we were able to utilize that. I'd be glad to answer any questions that you might have about fire season, and Tim is with us today to be able to do that as well. The request, again, as Susie just summarized, covers then our cost for implementing both the program that we utilized this past summer for the large air tanker coverage, as well as some additional helicopters that we put around the state to cover the needs for the severe season. And the balance balance, there is a positive balance of approximately $800,000 in the special purpose appropriation that, of course, we would not anticipate needing to utilize for the remainder of the biennium. I would just also mention that an important component of the request to you now is that one of our large fires this year, the Bland Mountain Fire down by Roseburg, became a FEMA-eligible fire, which means we receive FEMA dollars for a portion of that suppression cost because the fire threatened communities and homes. That FEMA eligibility does mean that we should receive 75% of the costs of fire suppression during a defined period of time of that fire, and we'll receive those dollars ultimately through FEMA. When that occurs, we also may see some of the costs of the large air tanker availability costs. That's the cost to get the air tankers on contract and have them available. Some of that cost may also be covered by FEMA under some rules that they are now working with. If that all comes to pass, and we expect the FEMA payments may get to us in about a year from now, then we'll be able to turn around and return those FEMA dollars to the state general fund to cover a portion of this request. It's about $1 million difference, and we're hopeful that it'll pan out that way. We expect it will in our initial conversations with FEMA. Unfortunately, the timing is not great, but in terms of getting those dollars back, it probably will be a year before we actually get the payments. And part of the reason for that is that we actually now are lower in the FEMA list because of the hurricanes in Florida, and probably rightfully so. So with that, I'd be glad to answer any questions that you might have this morning.
Senator Butler.
Chair, just a question of legislative fiscal. I assume that's the request is to the recommendation is to approve with instructions.
With instructions.
And I assume that instruction is then the repayment back to the general fund of the approximately $837,347.
That's your members of the committee. That's correct. Okay. That is my recommendation on the last paragraph of the analysis detail.
And that would when those FEMA monies come in, then that $800,000 would be returned to the general fund.
That's correct.
But that will be during the next biennium, it sounds like.
It could be during this biennium, okay. But it will be as late as the department anticipates. That will be November of 2005, but if FEMA moves faster, it could be sooner than that.
Thank you. I just wanted to clarify that with instructions.
Yeah, I was going to ask what the with instructions were, so thank you.
Sure.
Senator Messerly.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I don't have a question for the department, but I just wanted to make a comment that through a lot of hard work of the department, the difference we're seeing now in the cost of our fires compared to, 2 years ago, the Biscuit Fire. And I believe it's a difference of coordination and communication with the federal government as well as the different departments around the state to respond rapidly with a lot of force in programs such as this. And I think, you could argue whether it's been a severe fire season or not, but I think the coordination has had a lot to do with this. And I think probably more importantly, we have an excellent system in place now. Should we have a severe season, we can deal with it much better than we did 2 years ago. So just wanted to commend your folks and your hard work.
Thank you very much.
Representative Butler,
Madam Chair, I do move the allocation, the legislative fiscal recommendation with the instructions that are provided.
Okay. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. And Senator Messerly will carry. Okay. On to number 13.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, this is also a request from the Department of Forestry to increase their other funds expenditure limitation by $17.3 million. This is money that is that has been expended and will be repaid by cooperating agencies that have had fires on their lands. So it'll come from a variety of sources.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, again, Clark Seeley with the Department of Forestry. This request is actually now our fairly regular end of fire season request to you to simply raise the other fund limitation limit for us to be able to pay bills from the prior fire season. Most of these bills are dollars are expended for large fires. And again, we had a number of large fires this year. Those dollars typically get reimbursed to the department by either other federal agencies if we're taking suppression action on Forest Service land, for example, or FEMA. And this is a case where the FEMA dollars play both ways, or dollars that are reimbursed to the department by the Oregon Forest Land Protection Fund, the Emergency Firefighting Fund itself. And we have to have, of course, the expenditure limitation within the agency to spend those dollars and then receive the revenue from the fund. So this is the request to do that. We're confident now in November, looking back in the 2004 fire season, that our costs are reasonably accurate and that this additional other fund limitation will meet our need then to get us from now to June of next year. We did ask for out of the $17 million, we did ask for a $4 million amount that would be only utilized if, in fact, we ended up with a tougher than normal spring next year. If we got into a difficult situation in May or June of next year and in fact saw some large fire activity, we'd have expenditure limitation for that. But we requested that be unscheduled through the Department of Administrative Services until such time as it might be needed. And it may not, and if not, that's fine. Be glad to answer any questions.
Chair, I move that we approve the recommendation of legislative fiscal with the unscheduling of the $4 million pending the next fire season in the spring.
All right. You've heard the motion. Is there any discussion? Any objections? So ordered. Okay, thanks. Number 14.
Yeah,
Carrier. Oh, Carrier. Carrier.
Madam Chair, this is a quarterly report that the agency has been making on the budget note or progress on a budget note relating to the harvest and habitat modeling project and optimal timber harvesting.
Okay. Welcome.
Thank you again, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Clark Seeley, the Associate State Forester for the Department of Forestry.
And Steve Thomas, Assistant State Forester for the Oregon Department of Forestry.
This is our quarterly report to you on the harvest and habitat modeling project, and I'm just going to turn it over to Steve at this point and let him recap and bring you up to date on the progress of the project.
I'll just go ahead and provide you with some updates. As Susie mentioned, and Clark mentioned, we've been providing quarterly updates, so I'll kind of give you where we are now and some of the significant issues that have occurred in this last 3 or 4 months. Basically, one of the most exciting things is it looks like we're going to be able to start making our pilot runs with the Forest Grove District. One of the most incredible efforts that need to be made in this sort of thing is getting all the pieces to work together so that when you run the model, you actually can believe some of the numbers that are coming out of it. And so it's actually part of that effort has kind of delayed our project. We're about 6 to 8 weeks behind schedule right now, but we think we'll still be able to complete the project by the spring of 05, but late spring. But the exciting part is we hope to begin making intermediate model runs using Forest Grove as a pilot, and that district has enough complexity and has a number of the issues that the other districts are going to be facing that we'll be able to use that as a way to make sure things are running properly as we begin to bring Tillamook and Clatsop and the other districts online with the modeling effort. A couple of items I would mention in terms of significant issues regarding the project.
The harvest unit and access contract, this was a contract we went out and hired Logging Engineering International to look at. And one of the layers that we did not have in our initial modeling effort was actually the spatial layering, the spatial layer necessary to say these are logical harvest units and these are where the roads ought to be located in relationship to these harvesting units. And so that contract is doing that work, and we've verified that and had a field assessment of that work. And this will greatly improve the model so that when the model goes out there and say this parcel of land is eligible to be harvested, it'll also compare it to, well, is that a logical harvest unit and is that something that's reachable from our road system, versus in previous efforts it was unable to do that. We just didn't have that information available. So that is nearly completed on all the districts. The growth and yield contract, which we have with Mason, Bruce, and Gerard consultants, that's basically to create the yield tables. In other words, what is we have a current stand and what is going to happen as a result of the prescriptions that we apply on the ground, and how will those stands grow and what will they yield in terms of volumes down the road. And that's a very complicated process, and we have the world-renowned consultants. We're very fortunate to get Mason, Bruce, and Gerard working on that. And so they are just about finished with the major districts, Clatsop, Tillamook, and Forest Grove, in terms of developing the yield tables so that as we grow the trees in the model, we can be relatively sure that that's the volumes and that's the stand structure that we're going to get as a result of the activities we take place. So that's nearly completed. And
assuming you can plug in things like moderate Swiss needle cast and root rot and whatever else.
Swiss needle cast, yes. Senator Duke's Swiss needle cast will be built into the prescriptions, and we'll have appropriate reductions made based on the work that we've done on Swiss needle cast. In fact, I checked with staff this morning, and they were just really delighted. And I said, is there something I can pass on that's just going to really delight everyone? And for us, Dr. Sessions has just completed putting everything together for Forest Grove. Dr. Sessions works for Oregon State University, basically the author of this modeling effort. And he, last night, I was told, put everything together for the Forest Grove District. The man works incredible hours, so we're very pleased that that has been done. And the last thing I would mention is that the October meeting of the Board of Forestry, which was in Tillamook, we also discussed a little bit some of the elements of the modeling effort with them on the tour, but during the meeting we also went a little bit more in depth with them. They knew it was going on, but we really didn't have enough to kind of give them a presentation until October. They were very enthusiastic about the project, asked many questions, and we will be updating them through this winter and spring, help laying the foundation for them to look at the report and begin to digest that material when it comes out in late spring of 2005. So there was a great deal of enthusiasm on their part, and we look forward to continuing to meet with them and brief them on the activities for the modeling effort. So those are some of the highlights. I'd be happy to answer any questions you might have.
When was this model put together, the original?
The
one we're updating.
Senator Dukes, members of the committee. Dr. Sessions was involved in the initial modeling effort that was done in the late 90s before the first plan was approved. The model, the spatial layering and the way the model works, we're still using the same framework. What we are doing since April of 2003 is actually improving the model dramatically by bringing in new data and new GIS layers that will allow it to be a lot more accurate than it was previously. So the same framework is being utilized that we used when we approved the plan in 2001, but the outputs from the model should be greatly improved as a result of the work we've been doing since April of 2003.
Will there be regular updates after this, or...
Madam Chair, members of the committee, yes, we will be looking at updating the model on a periodic basis. It'll be part of our adaptive management. For instance, there's an issue that we're looking at right now that may not be quite completed by spring, and that is the issue of looking at Swiss needle cast and some recent research data that we have gotten from that. And it may change our approach to dealing with Swiss needle cast. It may give us an opportunity to do more thinning than regeneration harvest of Swiss needle cast. So that would actually be a change, and we would model that, then bring that back to the board and talk about should we make some changes. So there will be periodic changes. I would hesitate to say that we'd run a model year after year after year, but in some instances we will do that just to make sure that our data stays fresh and that we can answer questions as people bring them in.
What's the cost of this particular update?
The cost? Oh, boy. I don't have those figures right now. It's been the two projects that we had are probably around $700,000 or $800,000 just for the engineering and the growth and yield contracts. I would say that we're probably, with all the other people involved, we're somewhere at $1 million, but I can get an estimate of that for you.
And this will, I mean, we did this one as a result of all of the conflicting information we received last session. So this will put all that to rest?
It will fly.
I just hope they're all at the table.
Well, Senator Dukes, members of the committee, that's what we have tried to do. And if you remember, after the initial modeling effort and when the implementation plans were put together in March of 2003, the counties had been concerned about the volumes that were coming out of the implementation plans. And so we had a great deal of discussion with the counties about the modeling effort. And they, at that time, hired Mason, Bruce, and Gerard as a consultant to review that. The action plan that we developed and began working on in April 2003 and the budget note are based on the agreement that we developed with the counties in terms of saying these are the issues we need to address. And so we've been working basically on that action plan.
I think I sat through three separate presentations of theirs on how much you should be able to harvest. So I'm hoping all of the players are having access and input into this. So,
yes.
Okay. Yes, Senator Messerly.
Thank you. I think you were addressing the same question I had, and I think you answered, and that is that models are based on assumptions and that we need to continually review those assumptions or we can get really off base if we don't. But a specific question I have for you is I've become aware recently that, and this has implications in land use, that the Department of Forestry rates lands, forest lands, I guess, based on their ability to produce fiber, I guess, for lack of a better word. And it's come to my attention that where you have one species of plant or trees, that might work very well, particularly if there's more than one, if they have economic value. But if that ability to produce fiber also includes unmarketable, uneconomically feasible species, it can really skew the whole thing. Now, I don't know how this is working on the studies you're modeling here, on the areas you're modeling here, but in my area down in the South Coast, where we have tan oak and myrtle and brush, you know, we can grow volumes of this stuff, that if our models don't specifically talk about the economic values, we're really can get off base. Are you addressing that issue here in this study?
Senator Duke, Senator Messerly, members of the committee, we are looking at species compositions. We are taking into consideration both the current stands and the stands that we will be growing into the future and looking at multiple species in regards to that, as well as, you know, taking into account what's happening with the alder that's out there. So we are trying to address that in our modeling efforts, and that's, you know, an ongoing discussion in regards especially to Swiss needle cast as to what is the composition that we should be growing out on the coastal arena, and, you know, the growth of Douglas fir and the growth of hemlock and the growth of Sitka spruce and cedar are all different, and so how do we model that and how do we make that as efficient as possible? So we're working on that issue and trying to bring that degree of realism to the modeling effort.
If I could follow up, Madam Chair. I just thought of another issue, and I've had experience when I was in business with my family where we were attempting to buy a large parcel of timberland, very well stocked, and the last day we had the cruising company go in and bore those trees. They weren't growing. And so particularly when you're on slopes that get the north west wind and the cold winds off the ocean can have a tremendous impact on the ability of that land to produce as well as soil types and everything else. But luckily, we caught it quick enough. We didn't buy the property, but it could have been a disaster financially.
Thank you.
A non-growing golf course.
The South Coast, it's
okay. Okay.
Madam Chair, this is indeed a heartwarming report. I appreciate the comments that Steve and Clark have made to bring us some good news about the potential for our economic well-being through the foresting program. With that, I'd move to acknowledge the receipt of the report.
Okay. Representative Butler moves to acknowledge the receipt of the report. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Carrier. Senator Messer. Okay. Currently, number 10.
Chair, that's okay. The Department of Agriculture is here requesting an increase in their federal funds expenditure limitation of $980,000. I believe they'll be able to explain the reason for the increase request.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Katie Koba, Director of the Oregon Department of Agriculture, and with me is Lauren Henderson, also with the department. We have before you a request for a total federal funds increase of $980,000, and these are really a compilation of a number of federal funds grants that have all been previously authorized either by the legislature or by the E-Board. In summary, those include grants for animal disease surveillance related to multiple animal diseases that we're dealing with in this state, including mad cow, our confined animal feeding operation program, homeland security efforts, our USDA organic certification program, our Yoni's disease program, and our response to the BSE outbreak that we had earlier this year. Some of these grants, when they were approved, we agreed to use existing federal funds authority that we had in the agency. We knew we would need to come back to the emergency board. We've been working closely with staff to determine the total amount of limitation that we need, and we think that this will get us through the remainder of this biennium.
Madam Chair, just one question of the director. I understood that there was a second case of Jacob Creutzfeldt reported this just in the last 2 days. Was it in the U.S.? Is it an Oregonian case, another Oregon case?
There's a second case of mad cow disease in cattle that has come back as an inconclusive positive. So what USDA needs to do is take that test, send it to the testing facility. As I understand it, they'll be sending it to England to confirm whether that is indeed a positive. That will take 4 to 7 days to do that.
Was this an Oregon ruminant?
No. Well, okay. We have not been told where the animal is from, and they intend not to do that unless it comes back positive. We do have a conference call at 10:30 this morning with USDA to find out a little bit more information.
Thank you. Maybe by tomorrow we'll have some good information.
About that too.
Madam Chair.
Senator Messerly.
Katie, these have all been in dairy herds so far, is that right? Have we seen any in the feedlots?
Madam Chair, Senator Messerly, you're referring to the mad cow disease. The one case that we had in the U.S. was from a dairy animal that came from Canada. The previous case in Canada was from a cattle operation, not a dairy operation.
In the feedlot or in a cow-calf operation?
I'm not sure where the animal was when they actually picked it up.
Thank you.
No?
Chair, I move that we approve the request as recommended by LFO.
Okay. Representative Butler moves approval of the request. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. Okay. Representative Butler will carry that. Can still pronounce all these things.
BSE.
As if he knows.
We don't question it, yeah. Number 11. DEQ. Cool.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, the Department of Environmental Quality is before you requesting a federal funds expenditure limitation increase of $7,320,000 for their land quality program. The majority of this is due to additional funding made available by the federal government for Superfund cleanup of the McCormick and Baxter site, and I believe the department would be able to provide some further information.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Alan Kippett. I'm the Land Quality Division Administrator for DEQ. As Paul mentioned, the bulk of this request for increase in federal funds limitation is for the cleanup of the McCormick-Baxter Federal Superfund site. We were in front of this group in January of this year requesting some additional limitation and mentioned at that time that we would know later this year whether or not there was more money coming, and that's primarily the bulk of this request. The other portions of the request totaling up to $7.3 million are for other ongoing grant activities that have been approved by this committee or the legislature for our overall cleanup program for the Umatilla startup and for the underground storage tank program and other grant funds. So I'd be glad to answer any questions you may have on this.
Questions?
Madam Chair, just one and perhaps it's a rhetorical question. I've had some constituents anxious about the underground storage tank program in my district in southeastern Oregon and concerned about the fee for services and startup costs to restart the examination when the program ratcheted down. Now it's coming back up. Is there any possibility that these funds, and I see that there is $100,000 for the LUST program, is there any possibility that these funds are going to reduce the fines or the fees for services that this resource will reduce those?
Madam Chair, Representative Butler, unfortunately, the funds we are getting from EPA for the underground storage tank program are specifically earmarked for abandoned underground storage tanks. I'm aware of the situation you've mentioned, and this is an issue as division administrator that I am going to look into and get back to you on because
thank you very much.
There are some problems there that need to be addressed.
Other questions? No?
Madam Chair, I move that we approve the request at the recommendation of the Legislative Fiscal Office.
Representative Butler moves approval of the request. Any discussion? Any objections? So ordered.
Thank you.
Yes. A carrier. Okay. Number 15. Hello there. Report on biennial wood plan. Any comments before we get started?
Oh, well, Madam Chair, members of the subcommittee, the 2003 Legislative Assembly adopted a work plan for the Department of Land Conservation and Development and directed them to report to the Emergency Board twice and also, if necessary, request allocation of a special purpose appropriation. So they are here today to do that. This is the second of two reports, by the way.
Well, welcome back.
Thank you. Good morning, Madam Co-Chair, members of the committee. It's good to be here. For the record, Lane Shetterly, Director of the Department of Land Conservation and Development, and I can say that after 9 months, that's flowing a little more naturally than it might have the first time I was in front of you. I bring you good news in our report. I'll just introduce it by acknowledging that we are about 66% of the way through the biennium, and based on LFO's evaluation of the progress report that we have submitted to you, we are 88% of the way complete with the work plan that was given to the department at the through the last legislative session. And with regard to the special purpose appropriation, particularly for operations in the department, the amount that was withheld by the last legislative session was almost $276,000 for operations. We are here today requesting $54,979 of that, along with the balance of the appropriation for our grant fund to local governments and our landowner notification. So I would like to couch this as having done a little more with a little less, or substantially less, in terms of what the department was assigned and what we have accomplished, and hope that we may receive favorable action today on the LFO recommendation. I'd be pleased to answer any questions.
Are there questions?
I'm sure, I'm talking too much today, maybe, but because I'm not asking questions, just making comments. But, you know, as you know, Madam Chair, we were very concerned during the last legislative Ways and Means.
Representative Morgan and I were talking about that yesterday
afternoon.
And I'm
very pleased to see that you're moving ahead and answering a lot of the questions that we had. And I'm looking, hopefully, that it'll be a much easier budget session for you this year than it was past.
Thank you. We are hopeful of that as well. And I think we're in a good place. I'll tell you, as far as Christina can perhaps tell you, but so far the on the agency side, our budget development process has gone very, very smoothly. We're right on schedule and very few hiccups and not a lot of having to go back and do much over again. So I think in terms of the budget and management aspect of the program, we've made a lot of progress, and I think we're anticipating a much cleaner session as a consequence of that.
Representative Miller.
Beyond the brilliance of your appointment, what's the key to being able to do more with less, which probably should be something instructive to other agencies? But, you know, it's a glowing report. How'd you do it?
Well, thank you, Madam Co-Chair, Representative Miller, a lot of hard work. I'll tell you why. My personal perspective on this is that I usually spend an hour or two at home on the online in the evenings, and a good part of the time on weekends. And for instance, I'll be responding to an email that may have been left in my inbox at 8:00, 8:30 in the evening, and before I go offline at 10 or 11, I'll have a response back from one of my staff people. They're working, and working hard. And I think, too, we're doing a good job of engaging our local partners. The commission has been continuing its efforts to meet out in the communities. Since I've been at the department, we have met with the commission in Hood River, Klamath Falls, LaGrande, and Astoria. And I have been out, at least for the first, I would say, 6 months. I was gone probably close to half the time out traveling the state. And I can tell you that developing relationships with our local government partners is one sure way to reduce some of the costs that we might otherwise incur. And I can give you an example of that. We had a community, for instance, on the South Coast that we heard word of one day, had amended its comprehensive plan in a single city council meeting by adoption of a resolution. The procedure was all wrong, and in fact the purpose of it was to facilitate the development, the construction of a residential development right down on the sand, right up against and perhaps even crossing over the hazard line. So we had to send out to them a letter from the Department of Justice saying, you need to stop this. And it just happened that I was going down there the next week. I went down there. We met with their city council. We met with their planner and the developer. And with my regional staff and one of our coastal specialists, we went out to the beach to see where it was that they wanted to put this development. And in the course of about a half-hour meeting on the beach, we resolved all of the technical and all of the issues about the development they proposed. We agreed what they could do. They agreed it was entirely satisfactory to them. They rescinded their council resolution, accepted our recommendations for how to go through the process with the proper findings, and in a month they had appropriately amended their comprehensive plan and were on the process then, and that construction is underway. That's a case that I think could have ended up in 2 years of appeals with attorney general fees and our staff time on an ongoing basis that we resolved in short order. I think it's that kind of commitment to the community that really has helped us in a lot of ways cut some corners in the good sense of the word, and get to resolution of things that in other times could have taken a lot of expense and a lot of effort.
I mean, I guess that was in your district.
Oh, I don't think so. Probably south of my...
Yeah, I was going to say, it was a Curry County community. Yeah.
Used to be my district.
Yeah.
That other senator that we keep forgetting is a coastal senator.
That's right. Yeah.
Other questions?
Madam Chair, I want to express my appreciation, and I know that it's customary and tradition to go ahead and turn down a director's first request in these meetings and blackball them through the process.
And like the first bill that you carry on the floor.
First bill to carry, but recognizing that that the good director is accomplishing more with less, I don't want to take a chance of prolonging that agony with the first bill that crosses the floor. So with that, I would go ahead and move the recommendation of legislative fiscal for the three allocations of the special purpose appropriation resources in accordance with the special instructions and acknowledge the receipt of the report.
Representative Butler moves the LFO recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you, sir.
Carrier.
Yeah,
Representative Butler will carry that. Number 16.
I thought for sure we were going to be here until about 2 o'clock after the first couple of
them. I stopped talking at
night. We were going slow. I was watching the clock, too.
We've been down. I'll just go back and along.
That's my thought, too. Sue?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, members of the subcommittee, the Department of State Lands and Department of Forestry are here to, in response to a budget note that had been adopted, directing them to report on the status of ongoing projects related to the management of Common School Fund forest lands.
Okay. Welcome.
Good morning. It's good to be here. I think the I'm John Lilly, Assistant Director of Policy and Planning with the Department of State Lands. I think that the reports speak for themselves from the analysts, and I want to tell you, started with some summary comments and then get into some detail if you'd like. The budget notes asked us to report to you periodically on the progress on a number of issues relating to forest land management, particularly the Elliott State Forest, which is almost all common school forest land. The Elliott is managed on a contract between the Land Board and the Department of Forestry, and the Department of State Lands provides a liaison between the Land Board and the Department of Forestry. The Forest Management Plan and Habitat Conservation Plan being developed for the Elliott are on track. We expect to be able to have those products completed in the year 2005 and working diligently with the Federal Services, NOAA Fisheries and U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service to get their buy-in and buy-off on the Habitat Conservation Plan, which will take a little while longer after the initial approval of the Forest Management Plan by the Land Board.
Is that a marbled murrelet?
Yes.
HCP?
Yes. Madam Chair, marbled murrelets, spotted owls, and other listed or candidate species are being targeted in the Habitat Conservation Plan.
So
it's a multi-species.
It's an MCP, okay.
Yeah. The good news is that this last spring we went through both peer review of the plan by biologists and experts in various fields, as well as held public meetings on the proposed strategies in the draft forest plan. And we got very good feedback. In fact, forestry tells us that it was value-added feedback. In other words, it was just not simply form letters and such, that we got some good response. And, in fact, the peer review was very good. It's caused us to take another look at some of the strategies that we proposed and to fine-tune them. The second piece of good news in regards to the day-to-day management of the forest is that you asked us to look at both management costs and overall management, which means revenues. Timber prices are up. the sales that we've been doing have been receiving more dollars per 1,000 board feet than in previous years, and we expect to be able to keep the volumes up into the mid 20 million board feet level that is asked for in the current Elliott Forest Plan. And then finally, you asked us to report to you about our progress on the Elliott cost-benefit study. This was a budget note that was given to both the departments and formulated a hypothesis, and that was, what would the benefits be of selling the Elliott State Forest and depositing the money in the Common School Fund versus holding on to the Elliott and continuing to manage it for revenue over the long term as a benefit for the Common School Fund Trust. That project is underway. We expect to have that project completed and reported to the Land Board at its December 14 meeting, and we expect to be able to report it out to the legislature in January 2005.
Questions? Senator,
I do, Madam Chair. We had a lot of discussions at the last session, again, in ways and means over the HCP. And I think the rest of the committee, I know I felt very awkward because the timber industry, forest industry, was telling us that HCPs are not valuable and they're too restrictive, and yet the government agencies were saying that this is something that we have to do. It seems to me that it really comes down to whether we manage our public forest based on the Forest Practices Act or we manage them on something closer to the Clinton Northwest Forest Plan. And I guess it's a little bothersome to me as I read in the report, the State Land Board has made the statement, a very strong statement, that they have no intentions of selling the LA State Forest, and I would assume that's true. But my concern is that we're skewing the study if we make that assumption first and then go out and try to decide whether we can generate more funding for the Common School Fund based, if we're harvesting based on the Forest Practices Act as opposed to based on the on a more stringent plan. I'm concerned that we're not going to get a good study here if we're not very careful. If there's some assumptions made before we even get really into the study, could you respond to that,
Madam Chair? Senator Meserle, I think any study of the nature that we're involved in with this cost benefit study needs to be done as objectively as possible, and that's what we've charged our consultant to do. The consultant that we've retained is Mason, Bruce, and Gerard. As you've already heard, they're well familiar with the Habitat and Harvest project, the H&H project that's currently underway. They're familiar with the management of Common School Forest lands as well as Board of Forestry lands. You know, I'm confident that we'll get an objective report. I think ultimately what the Land Board has said in regards to the sale of the Elliott is that they view it as an asset of the Common School Fund. It's an important part of the balancing of the real estate portfolio, and it is the highest producing land asset that the Common School portfolio currently has. In terms of real estate. Obviously, the board will have the opportunity to revisit all of its decisions about the Elliott and all the other lands that it deals with when it reviews both the report from Mason, Bruce, and Gerard, as well as, in about a year from now, the asset management plan that the department is currently starting and will have underway.
Sure, could I follow up?
Absolutely.
And I don't mean to belabor this, but it was of concern to me, at least, as chairman of the committee, that the State Land Board put additional conditions on the study, meaning that to consider water quality, habitat, and there might have been one or two other conditions on that. And my concern here is that the Forest Practices Act also protects those very same issues. and I've never heard a justification of why the Elliott should be managed at a more stringent level than the protection we already have under the Forest Practices Act. And I think that I'm bringing that up a second time because I think that's really key as to how this study moves forward as to the value of the timber. And yes, the values are up, but the comparison should be, could we produce more value as a private forest or as a public forest?
Madam Chair, Senator Meserle, I think that's one of the interesting outcomes, hopefully, that we'll be seeing in the cost-benefit study, is that as we've tasked the consultant to look at what would various entities that are in the forest land managing and land-owning business, how would those various entities approach valuing the Elliott, and which in turn is going to require them to look at what their business model would be if they were to acquire. And the RFP that we put out lists those various business models, practices that we're asking them to model. So I think that there will be an opportunity to look at those comparisons. And I think that those comparisons will be powerful tools that the departments can use in their conversations with the federal services, and will help to inform the land board as it moves forward with adopting a forest management plan on the Elliott. I mean, it's part of the due diligence that the board is desirous of doing in making the right decisions for how to manage this very valuable asset.
I guess refresh my memory. We have the Forest Practices Act for private timberlands. We have the Forest Management Plan for the I'm not sure what to call it, the state forest lands, but the County Forest Trust state forest lands. And then is there a separate management plan for the Elliott?
Madam Chair, the Elliott is a 93,000 acre forest in Coos and Douglas County. 86,000 acres of those are common school forest lands managed by the land board or owned by the land board.
They're physically managed under contract to the Department of Forestry. But I'm just asking, I didn't recall, is there a third management
plan? There is a management plan specifically for the Elliott Forest. And the Elliott Forest is the only state forest that we have managed currently under a federally approved habitat conservation plan for northern spotted owls.
I'm still working for the one on the other. How, maybe this isn't the time to get into this, I was just curious, maybe we can talk some other time, how it differs. One of the things that does frustrate me, I don't necessarily share all of Senator Messerly's concerns on forestry, but to have three forest management plans in this state that I'm assuming are considerably different, because the first two I know are considerably different, just strikes me as strange.
Yeah, Madam Chair, on the Elliott, the board adopted the Elliott Forest Management Plan and Habitat Conservation Plan
1995.
Yeah, about 10 years ago.
For the state forest management.
Correct. And the driver there was that we had northern spotted owl listings, we had marbled murrelet listings, and we were quickly getting into a situation where the harvest levels were being reduced drastically. And a plan and an HCP was deemed to be, by the board, to be the most prudent approach. At the same time, the board took an aggressive approach and said that they felt that it was wise to look at the watershed-based management of the Elliott as well as the aquatic protection to be in place so that if there were listings of anadromous fish, that we'd be out ahead of that. And I think that was a good strategy at the time. And I think now that the kind of plan we're looking at, where we're looking at multi-species coverage, we're a little smarter than we were 10 years ago. We have a little more science, and we know a little bit more about how to negotiate HCPs with the services. We think that we're in good shape to be able to move forward with a plan that will look and give us revenues and harvest levels that will be positive for the Common School Fund.
Thank you. it's fair to say that the next session of the legislature will be revisiting that issue and watching it carefully. As we go to put up sales, no matter where they are, whether they're private, one type of state or another type of state lands, some consistency seems to be valuable. And I know that Senator Messerly is exactly right. There are a lot of questions about HCPs, and we may know a lot more about them than we did before, but so far we are no more successful in acquiring them. So I'm sure you know. There'll be questions next session as well. There are other questions.
HCPs. What's the current restriction when it comes to harvest around an owl nest?
Chairman, members of the committee, Representative Miller. Aquatic and riparian strategies are fairly complicated, and I cannot remember them all. I've got a matrix at the office that tells me what they are now and then what we were proposing under the new plan. So I think probably the best thing for me to do would be able to just send that to LFO and distribute that to the committee, and then if you have questions we can answer. But basically we have developed a set of strategies that we believe address the issue of properly functioning aquatic habitat. And that is not only provides shade, but it provides vegetation for multiple species in those arenas, plus the issue of how do we provide large wood into the system, which is also part of that functioning habitat. So, you know, we've developed a set of strategies to try to address that on state forest lands, and that is going to represent somewhat of a change from the current plan that's in existence on the Elliott. And so we can get you those things, but I just wouldn't want to try to state them right now because, like I say, I've got a matrix at the office that tells me what those are.
The figure that jumps into my head was the last time I remember dealing with this, it was a 70-acre circle around the nest.
That's
off limits.
Representative Miller, that's correct. That's Forest Practices Act. It's a 70-acre circle around the nest, and that's protect the nesting site.
That's been in effect for a decade, or?
I can't tell you exactly when it's been in effect for quite a while. But that is to protect the nesting site. That landowners also know that that doesn't guarantee take avoidance in terms of the federal services.
Right. I'm just wondering that since that was implemented, is that continually reviewed to see whether or not that's either been helpful, and if it has been, whether or not that acreage ought to shrink?
Senator Duke,
it'd be nice members, if we all had a 70-acre circle.
Right. Representative Miller, I would propose that we can provide you with information that we have done research in the state forest program on northern spotted owls. There's been a great deal of research done on northern spotted owls. If you look at it in terms of what the Forest Practices Act is requiring, I cannot tell you at this point in time what their research has been done in that particular area. But our research on state forest has shown that in order to go beyond the issue of just protecting the nesting site, it requires a great deal more acres than 70 acres. That's what our research has shown, and this is recent research. If we're going to, as a state agency, not only going to, if we're going to protect the site as well as avoid take, we've always felt it takes more acres than that on state forest land. Though there is research out there, more recent research than was done with the 70-acre core. We can get you that information if you'd like.
Well, maybe I'm hearing something that you say it takes more acreage on state forest land to protect. Are you saying
that's
that it
what
takes
we're applying
less acreage on private forest land, or are you just saying your experience is and it's limited only to the state land? Or
we are applying a larger acreage on state forest land than the 70-acre core. That's what the research has shown that we needed to do to avoid take.
My question is, does that mean that there would be a different experience on private land? If so, what?
I think it would be best if we bring the forest practices folks in for that discussion as to why there hasn't been a change in the 70-acre core area and the research associated with it.
Population declining?
In certain areas, the population has declined. For a variety of reasons, that study has just been completed. And showing in particular areas there has been a decline, not in the range, not necessarily. I think Oregon's population has remained fairly stable. But again, that's an area that I do not deal with in terms of the total state. So I wouldn't want to give you, if you're interested in that information, we can bring that to you. But that research has just been recently completed as the federal services are reviewing the issue of listing the owl or not listing the owl.
What's the protection generally for the murrelet? Is that how many acres once you sense some problem?
Senator Dukes, Representative Miller, members of the committee. The acreage for protection of a murrelet site is quite a bit different. Basically, we look at the demographic where the species has been located, where they're nesting. But the issue that makes them dramatically different is they don't live in the forest. They use the forest as a nesting area. So they don't use it for habitat, for foraging, and that sort of thing. So we have areas that may be 50 acres. We have some areas that may be 200 acres or so around a nesting site, depending on where it sets in relationship to the nesting trees and other activities. So it's quite a bit different. Each site is individually appraised by our biologists to determine what will be the scope of the protection needed for the nesting site. So there is no standard for that in terms of a specific size of acreage.
Thank you.
On the owl, whatever we're doing in the Elliott, is it the same thing we're doing in the other forests on the spotted owl?
Senator Dukes, members of the committee, I would say that what we are doing and have been doing since the HCP is a similar approach that we were doing on the rest of the forest. In other words, we're looking at the area necessary to set aside for grazing, for foraging, and for roosting, and looking at their home ranges and trying to decide what acres we're going to have to put aside. So it's a similar concept to what we're doing on the rest of looking at with the HCP strategies on the North Coast, similar sort of approach. But remember now, we have a habitat conservation plan in place for owls on the Elliott right now, and those strategies that we developed in
95
are still in place. And so what we're looking at now is saying, well, can we do a better job of working with the owl and with the services and managing the land? And so we're looking at, is there anything we need to do to change those strategies from what we had in the past? So we are reviewing that, but right now we do have a habitat conservation plan for owls on the Elliott.
This is somewhat unrelated, but the discussion leads to it. And that is that in the private sector, with the passing of Ballot Measure 37, how does that, have you had discussions in the department how that's going to impact your setting limits on set-asides for murrelets or spotted owls or anything?
Senator Dukes, Senator Mesley, members of the committee, to my knowledge, we haven't had any specific discussions. Ballot Measure 37 is created more questions than answers, and so we haven't reached any particular direction on that arena yet.
Sure, I'm just reminded of the dilemma here, I somewhat facetiously ask what happens when a marbled murrelet moves its nest to within the 70-acre spotted owl's domain.
I don't think it's a pretty sight when they do that.
and that's, again, the dilemma, yeah, the short stay of what happens when you see a
one of the protected wolves eating a spotted owl at that point. I'm not sure what you do, whether you're supposed to tell them shoo or take a BB gun and just pepper one versus the other. I'm not sure what happens.
Yeah. And like Bo Trout, he
eats salmon. That's what I was going to say, yeah.
It's one of those terrible dilemmas that we've got. Protected. Madam Chair, I move that we acknowledge receipt of the report.
Okay. Representative Butler moves the LFO recommendation. Is there any more discussion? Any objection? Supported. Thank you. Carrier. Senator Messerly, I'm just going to assume that you wanted to carry this.
But Representative Miller hasn't done much. Have you noticed that?
I hadn't. Would you like to carry this one?
No, I'll do it.
Okay. I mean, I moved it into this subcommittee just so you could hear the report and respond. Senator Messerly's going to take that. But we've got five more.
Oh, yeah.
Representative Miller.
You're saying Miller's name all over the next five.
And before we get started with the next one, I've been handed a note that we have Professor Richard Klukas of Portland State University and some political science students. Is that accurate? Can we ask you all to stand up so we can see you and welcome you? This is what we do every couple of months. And I don't know, has anybody told you what we're doing in here besides just spending a couple of hours talking to each other?
Maybe LFO can tell us what we're doing.
We all serve on the Budget Writing Committee, and we helped write the budgets for a two-year period of time, which is how Oregon budgets. And when we're not in session, we come in every other month and review those budgets and specific actions that we had asked agencies to take. So that's or requests from the agency to modify their budget in some way or other. So that's what we're here doing today. We're the General Government Subcommittee, so we handle kind of hodgepodge of things.
Madam Chair, members of the subcommittee, the Department of State Lands is here to request retroactive approval of a grant application, and I would like to mention that they met all the requirements as far as notifying leadership. They are also asking for some additional expenditure limitation and a limited duration position. And I would just like to mention, when we get to the LFO recommendation, I just need to make a minor modification.
Okay.
As Sue mentioned, for the record, Chair Dukes, members of the committee, I'm Ann Hannes, Director of Department of State Lands. We are requesting retroactive approval for a federally funded grant for the South Slough National Estuary and Reserve. As Sue mentioned, the timing of when we received notice of it and when we had to get our application in came right in the middle between the two emergency boards. The grant will allow us to synthesize water, nutrient, and weather data that's been collected from real-time monitoring equipment. This is going to benefit coastal communities by increasing our understanding of short and long-term changes in estuary and tidal basins and how they're driven by freshwater inputs from coastal watersheds versus the tidal forcing of marine waters from the ocean. It also will increase our understanding about contaminants, particularly from nutrient loading at several locations within the estuaries for nitrates, phosphates, and solids. And this is especially important for the oyster industry. This is going to be conducted in partnership with four other Pacific region reserves from California to Alaska.
Questions?
Madam Chair, it sounds like they're going to get a huge amount of work done for $70,000 of federal funds. I wonder if we could get all of that work done with general funds from the state, too.
That was Representative Miller.
Well, by itself, it seems fairly innocuous, but every year or every meeting, we have another little hit going into this
South Slough
little place that I've personally visited. And
he's back. You can't defame it anymore.
Well, I guess I shouldn't be mindful of the federal government increasing their debt limitations so they can continue to dribble money into things like this. But I'm wondering, what is the total budget at the South Slough Estuarine? sanctuary.
And could I comment? I don't think that's why the federal government is extending their debt limitation.
Well, there's a combination of things like this that add up. And whether or not this is vital to the national interest, I'm not sure it is.
I don't know. We'll find out what the budget is for the South.
I guess Pamela Constantopoulos, she's our fiscal manager and acting director of finance and administration.
Co-Chair Dukes, members of the committee, the total budget for South SLU is approximately $2 million. It's split approximately 50-50 between other funds, limitation, and federal funds.
Is that annual or biennial?
That's biennial.
If I could add to that, Madam Chair, sure. The state's part comes out of the Common School Fund. And we spent a lot of time, as you know, talking to the department that they should work very hard this coming biennium to reduce that funding from the Common School Fund, generate more funds within the sanctuary contracts, whatever they can do, rentals, whatever.
Okay. Other questions?
In the limited duration, you had some additional instructions, Sue.
Yes, Madam Chair and members of the subcommittee, would you like me to just go over the eligible recommendation at this point? Okay. The grants for $70,000, that bridges both the end of this biennium and goes into the next biennium. So they actually need about $27,000 in federal funds limitation for the 03-05 biennium. So that's one piece of the recommendation, and that would be with the understanding that DAS would unschedule the amount until they receive notification that their grant application has actually been approved, and they provide some additional expenditure information to LFO that they showing that they still need the additional limitation, in other words, that they can't absorb it in their existing limitation. And likewise with the FTE, because the grant activities will start around March of 2005, rather than a 0.25 FTE, they need a point. It says 0.167 in my analysis, but DAS has informed me that they would prefer that I say 0.17 because that is consistent with how they enter FTE into the PICS system. So I'm very willing
to change. Yes, from
0.167 to 0.17.
Each there, Representative Butler.
0.17.
Yes, that's the change.
And so the remaining part of the recommendation is to give them their retroactive approval for the grant application.
Okay. Then Representative Butler moves the LFO recommendation with the change that the 0.167 FTE will be changed to 0.170 FTE. Any discussion? Any objection?
I'm going to object.
One objection. 2-3. Okay, so ordered. As long as I've got three, we're moving.
I'm sure I'll carry.
Not because I told you the next five were open. We're going to get five no's now.
This is a prospective rejection notice. He's saying no on all the rest of the five.
Yeah.
All right, Senator Messerly will carry that one. Number 18, still Division of State Lines. Sue?
Right. Madam Chair and members of the subcommittee, the 2003 Legislative Assembly also adopted a work plan for the Department of State Lands and directed the department to report to the Emergency Board. They previously reported in January, I believe, of this year. And there was some limitation, or requested to ask to unschedule some limitation until they reported back in January. When they reported, the recommendation was to have half the limitation rescheduled. And the Emergency Board went along with that recommendation. And the department is here to provide you with an update on their plan and also to request that DAS reschedule the remaining limitation.
Thank you. Again, for the record, Chair Dukes, members of the committee, I'm Ann Hannes, Director of Department of State Lands. I'm very pleased that we've continued to make significant progress on actions that have been outlined in our plans. We've completed 39 of 59 actions set forth in the work plan, and three more will be done by the end of the legislative session, and seven have been completed in part. Some of the actions were delayed because of workload or unanticipated projects or items outside of our control. We've extended the comment period, for example, and seeking sign-off from the federal agencies has delayed the statewide programmatic general permit, but we're hoping that that will move forward by the end of this year or early next year. There was also an alder petition that took a great deal of time before the land board, as well as a grazing fee audit that we're involved with doing, forming a grazing fee committee to review that. We've been involved extensively in the Portland Harbor cleanup, and then also we have submitted in our application to the Bureau of Land Management to seek 3,200 acres of in-lieu lands that the state is owed from the federal government. We've made great progress on improving customer service over the last 2 years. For example, Removal Fill customer services survey for the calendar year 2003 through June 2004 was recently completed. For the 18-month period, the percentage of customers rating DSL Removal Fill Program staff services, the equivalent of good to excellent, has climbed from a composite of 61% during the January-June 2003 period to 76% in the January-June 2004 period. Furthermore, of those attending August and September unclaimed property seminars that completed the surveys, there were 139 attendees. In response to all the questions, at least 95% of the employees ranked the materials presenters and locations as excellent or good or the equivalent. We've also been a very strong supporter of the economic revitalization team. This morning you may have heard, for example, that Amy's Kitchen, located to Southern Oregon, we were very active in that, making sure that wetland issues were dealt with, and as a result, they are going to be able to locate in Southern Oregon. Lebanon is another example of a site that we worked on. In total, for the past year, there have been 19 industrial sites certified, and all of these sites included our involvement. We're planning a reorganization of the agency that will enable us to focus on achieving goals established in our strategic plan. We're going to create divisions that will be now actually reforming three divisions into three new divisions of land management, wetland and waterway conservation, and finance and administration. As a result, we have cut our budget request by $700,000 with that reorganization. The focus of what we're going to be trying to do in the years ahead is increasing revenues to the Common School Fund through more aggressive land management and by carrying out our asset management plan recommendations, implementing streamlining efforts, and then also looking at moving unclaimed property with legislation in the next session to the treasurer, because many of the unclaimed property programs are with the treasurer. So we will present this planned reorganization before Ways and Means next year before implementing it.
Thank you. Are there questions?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Messer.
And I apologize. I forgot to ask you this question when we met in Coos Bay, but has there any work been done on the historical filled wetlands? I know we didn't get that in your work plan, but there's a lot of discussion last session about that, and I assume there's some work going on during the interim.
Yes, there has been, Senator Messerly. What we agreed to do, and we followed through with that, is that we have worked with those that were involved with Senate Bill 836, and we drafted questions to submit to the Department of Justice because there were key legal issues that needed to be addressed. After receiving feedback from, I guess, Jay McCauley, Martha Pagel, Chuck Bennett, we revised those questions, submitted those to the Department of Justice. They have said that they are going to have the advice to us by the end of this year, so it will be ready for the next biennium or for the next legislature.
Thank you.
I wanted to ask a little bit about the survey of satisfaction, which good marks. When do you make that? When is the survey conducted?
We do several things. One, whenever we have an application, we provide them with a card like this. that allows people to fill out, you know, have they received courteous service, have they received the information, a number of things. And it can just be torn off and sent in the mail. People can also go online to our website, and they can do the survey online. And then to make sure, because not everybody fills these out, we conduct every summer a telephone survey of a random sample of all our applicants to make sure that what we're getting from here validates the responses. So we do it several different ways.
Are those responses anonymous?
Some are, and sometimes people put their names on them. But they have the choice of anonymity if they want.
I'm thinking it's not quite the same with your outfit, but if you've just gone through an audit with the IRS and they said, did you enjoy our survey? Are you totally satisfied? You probably feel like you ought to say yeah and get out of there. If you say no, maybe they'll get another visit.
I think that by allowing people the opportunity either to, you know, put their name down or to do it anonymously, I think gives them that opportunity to convey, you know, concerns that they might have. And it really does help us to be able to, I felt it's been very valuable as a manager that it targets where there might be issues that we need to address with staff or to commend staff and to show people that this is a good way of doing it.
Just also a follow-up on Senator Messerly's question regarding the historical fills. As a practical matter, and maybe you've all reviewed this, if a property owner has some filled land, if they've been paying taxes on the land that's been filled, is there an assumption that it's in their ownership as opposed to the state's?
He's handled the property management.
If the assumption is not, and the state decided to claim ownership, would that taxpayer be refunded all of those past paid taxes?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Steve Purchase, Assistant Director for Field Operations for the Department of State Lands. Representative Miller, to answer your question, if a landowner has been paying taxes on land that they do not own, under state law today, the county is responsible for refunding past due taxes or taxes that were collected in error. Unfortunately, the legislature, when they established that law, also put a limit on that. And the limit is they will only pay back the previous 3 years. So when a county assessor does their tax assessment, they generally try to make sure that they have identified the true owner of the lands. Your other question was, if you pay taxes, does that give you some ownership right?
Is that just evidence that it's, as you said, the county goes out and researches it, and to their satisfaction, that is the owner's property, and therefore they can tax it? Is that?
Representative Miller, member of the committee, our experience has been that when a county tries to do a tax assessment on some area that is a questionable ownership, they have come to us and asked us if we have a claim. And if we think we have a claim, we tell them that, and then they have to make their own tax determination. We can't make that for them. But my experience has been is the county does not charge tax on a historical fill if they're aware of it. Back in the 1970s, just as a matter of follow-up, we did inform and involve all the local county tax assessors on a major fill land study that was completed in the 1970s. So the county assessor at that time had knowledge of all the areas that we thought were historically filled.
Thank you.
Welcome.
Representative Butler?
Director Hannes indicated that I think that you're finishing up about 18 or 19 of the sites, the industrial sites, have been participating in identifying and working forward to get those industrial lands identified for the economic stimulus. Have any idea? Are we pouring concrete on any of those? Any construction going on of the 19 that have been approved?
I believe that on the 19, I can get you the exact numbers on that, but I know on at least several of those, we already have commitments from people that are going to be buying the lands. So I don't know if construction has actually taken place, but I know...
Are you going to buy some land, but no construction that you're aware of?
It may be too soon, because the lands were just certified earlier this year. So I'm not sure if they've actually poured concrete or not, but I can get you those numbers.
Well, I guess I'm anxious. We're 2 years into the governor's duty and responsibility, and that was one of his high priorities. It'd be nice before... another election comes up, but maybe we have some construction started, let alone jobs on any of those sites.
And I believe that there will be construction on them. It's been really exciting working on that and seeing that move forward. And then what our plan is, I believe it's 25 certified sites then each year.
Well, I appreciate it. I'm just anxious that we have some economic stimulus going on in the state of Oregon. I visited with a businessman from Oregon who is building several million dollars worth of new factory sites in Texas, and his comment was that he couldn't wait 4 years to get the factory sites in Texas, that it took him a matter of anywhere from 2 or 3 weeks to from beginning to end on sites that were already identified in the vast wilderness of Texas that they could move on to, and they're unfortunately, this is an Oregon-based company, but not for long. Hmm. So, I'm just anxious about sites that take 4 years in order to just get, up to a slow pace, and then we might be able to approve those sites for some industrial work.
Well, all these sites have gone through expedited review, so we've really worked hard to get them online as quickly as possible and also work to try to have sites throughout the state, not just concentrated in one area.
Again, Mr. Chair, I just am anxious when we talk about expediting, and it takes us years to expedite, when it takes us virtually years to do things that other states are doing in a matter of days, then I'm really concerned about how much economic stimulus we have going on here. Thank you.
In fact, I heard this morning, driving down here, there was some report about the fastest-growing cities and most job-creating cities in the country, and there were no Oregon cities on this fairly long list of cities, and that may be one of the impediments.
Continue to head the list, however, of unemployment.
Senator Messerly.
Well, first I just want to comment on Representative Butler's statement there that it is true. Oregon is at a tremendous disadvantage, and I think until we resolve this issue, we're not going to move our economy forward like we need to keep pace, not only for our own benefit, but to keep pace with the rest of the country. But there's other issues. I've always thought that it was federal agencies, Corps of Engineers, and those kind of agencies, Fish and Wildlife, as well as our Oregon agencies. What I'm beginning to hear now is people say, hey, we're figuring out, there's room for improvement, but we're figuring out better how to deal with the Corps and how to deal with the DSL and other state agencies. But local government is stepping in now and putting their own conditions on, and sometimes that can be just a real deal breaker. And so I don't know how maybe Elaine Shetterly can deal with some of that, but it's a combined effort of all the entities, public entities, that are driving our business away. It's not just one. But that's not the reason I raised my hand, Mr. Chair. I wanted
to. Time's expired, I'm sorry.
That's probably appropriate, too. When Mr. Purchase was up, and he mentioned that they've identified to the counties the land that the state thinks they own or lay claim to, I think that's a key word, because a lot of those lands, correct me if I'm wrong, have not been adjudicated in court. And so although the state makes a claim, such as navigable waters, until it's adjudicated in courts, it's really not a decision. And so that leaves a lot of gray area. And I know you're working on that, trying to clarify that, but that is a point of distinction that is still a difficult issue.
Thank you. Further discussion? Questions? Representative Butler, you move
the request.
Approve the request. Discussion, objection. If not, it's approved.
Thank you very much.
And you're going to carry it.
And I will carry it. Yes, I will. Now up for bid is item 35, Public Employees Retirement System.
Dallas.
Mr. Chair.
Welcome.
You are welcome.
Number 35, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, is the Public Employees Retirement System coming forward with a request for funding to continue work on its conversion from its old computer system to its new. You have representatives from the agency here, but to let you know that the Joint Legislative Committee on Information Management Technology reviewed this at its meeting on Tuesday, and you have its recommendation before you. It essentially recommended approval of the staff recommendation.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Paul Clary, Executive Director of PERS. With me this morning is Jeff Marisik, our Chief Information Officer. I'm now moving into my 6 month on this job and still getting asked the same question that I got asked in my first couple of weeks on the job, and that is, are you going to be able to fix the problems up there? And it's up there because it's up in Tigard, and I think anything north is always up there. But I can tell you that I learned earlier in my career that the only way you can answer that kind of a question is say yes. But I am saying yes with a lot more confidence now than I was 6 months ago. And I'm doing that because of four different things. One, we've got a lot better handle on what the problems are and what needs to be done to correct them. Two, we're developing a comprehensive set of metrics so we can measure what we're managing, so we can track our progress, and we can be proactive in our problem identification and avoidance. Three, we've got a highly qualified, experienced, and engaged board and good people on staff that are working on the problems, and we've been able to attract some good people, and one of them is sitting next to me here. And four, we're implementing new tools and improving our processes on a continuous basis. And we're here today to talk with you about a key tool for us, and that is our RIMS conversion project, a project that will allow us to align our people, our processes, and our technology so we can improve our service delivery to our members, to our employers, and Oregon's taxpayers. We've got presentation that we gave to the JLCIMT. I'm not going to go through that in any detail, but I did want to turn your attention to, on page 3, slide number 5, kind of our project objectives. How are we going to measure success, if you will? And we believe that we'll be successful when we have substantially met the desired outcomes set by the PERS board, and you'll see those in the earlier slides, our mission and objectives statements. When we've significantly improved timeliness and accuracy of benefit estimates and benefit calculations, when we minimize the number of calculations that have to be done manually, when we've got a single integrated technology system handling both the Chapters 238, that's the Tier 1 and Tier 2, and the 238A plan components, and that's the OPSR of the House Bill 2020. When we fully decommission RIMS, when we've got an integrated workflow and imaging capabilities, when we provide our members and employers with web-enabled self-service capabilities, and when we've got trained and fully capable staff using the system. I think one of the things that we have identified as a major risk with any kind of technology conversion project, and one that we've developed a mitigation strategy for, is the need to have the business operations side of the agency driving the train. And so you'll see in our strategy that we've got a key focus on that information technology. Jeff's staff will be certainly an integral part of the team, but what we call our resident subject matter experts, our people from the different parts of our business operations, are going to be leading that team so the project meets business needs rather than just the needs of the technology staff. We're going to achieve that by actually pulling some of our mid-level managers off of their duties and assigning them onto this core team. And for the remainder of this biennium, we want to be able to do that with three positions. And so you'll see in our request
a request for funding authorization and position authorization for 0.75 FTE. What we're doing is we're pulling the resident experts, putting them on this team, and we're backfilling them with people that we're recruiting from outside or from within the agency. We found it's a lot easier for us to go out and recruit a manager, if you will, as opposed to try to replace or find somebody who's got 15 years of subject matter expertise. In the presentation, you'll see the staging of this project. It is we estimate it to be a 44-month project. We are going to start using the functionality of the new system, though, as soon as we bring it online. And on slide 9 on page 5, you can kind of see the schedule of where we're going to utilize the Clarity system. And this is the system that we selected for implementation of House Bill 2020. You'll see we right now are using Clarity. It's the CL in shading for employer reporting, employer maintenance, cash receipts, cash disbursements, and our general ledger. The next stage that we're working on is enrollment and demographic, and as we roll that in, we'll start utilizing the Clarity system for that, and you can see how we're phasing it in throughout. And we're doing that so we can actually generate benefits from this project as early as possible. You'll see that we're looking at doing this over the course of the remainder of this biennium and the next two. Total project estimated cost with a 10% contingency of $27.5 million. And our request today is for about $2.09 million in expenditure limitation and those 0.75 FTE for the limited duration positions, three of them for the remainder of the biennium. Due to Dallas's knowledge of both history as well as sharp pencil and sharp eye, he's identified a way for us to fund this without increasing our bottom line, and we're certainly appreciative of that. We had some money that had been allocated previously but put on the parking lot in an unscheduled manner, and Dallas is recommending that rather than increase our expenditure limitation, we just get a request from the emergency board to DAS to reschedule that amount of money, and we're appreciative of that recommendation. As Dallas had indicated, we've been working extensively with DAS IRMD on this project, and we did get a positive recommendation out of the JLCIMT on Thursday. With that, we're open for questions.
I'm sure just a question of Dallas, follow-up from the JLCIMT. They concurred with the rescheduling of existing funds.
That is correct.
Okay. And the reason for the limited duration nature of these is it thought that somewhere in the process that they'll be able to use existing employees to go ahead and take over these functions once the J Clarity is up and running.
Mr. Chairman, of the committee, yes, the existing employees will be assigned as kind of the business drivers on this group to for the conversion. The limited duration positions are the people that will be coming in behind them to either through the ranks or from outside to kind of handle the day-to-day operations that these people are truly experts in but have a broader knowledge of the agency's business. So these limited duration positions will probably continue through the project, will phase out as the project heads towards its ending.
Great. Thank you very much. I appreciate
it.
All right.
Other questions? No?
Madam Chair, I would then move that the recommendation of the JLCIMT as approved by the JLCIMT and as recommended now by Legislative Fiscal Office be the approved recommendation on behalf of number 35.
All right. Representative Butler moves approval of the LFO recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered.
Thank you.
And Representative Butler will carry that one.
Madam Chairman, number 37 is a request from the Department of Revenue for additional other funds expenditure limitation to continue work on what is called its ORMAPS, or property tax database system. Geographic Information System, I think is GIS, but that's the request. It's other funds limitation is what they're requesting.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Elizabeth Harshenko, Director of your Department of Revenue. This request, as Dallas has advised, is a request for an increase in other funds limitation of $1.5 million for the remainder of this biennium. The legislature authorized the Department of Revenue to create an Oregon Land Information System. I believe it was in the 1999 legislative session, and funded those activities through a $1 recording fee on documents that are recorded at the county, real estate transactions and other kinds of documents that are recorded in the counties. Those dollars come to the department, and we have an advisory committee that consists of federal, state, local government partners, as well as private sector partners, who have developed a policy for dispensing those dollars in the form of grants to the counties to develop a digitized property tax base map system. The system will actually serve two purposes. One, the primary purpose, to provide the assessors with the accurate maps that they need in order to administer the property tax system. But secondly, and probably of more excitement, I think, to our other partners, is that the property tax base will serve as a base data layer upon which other geographic information system applications can be built. And we expect that the kinds of uses that that data layer will be put to in the future will include public safety planning, zoning planning, airshed management, watershed management, wildlife management, just a wide variety of different applications that need the data but would use it in different ways. So we have been accumulating funds, have been dispensing grants. We set four goals for ourselves early on. The first one was to get a website just up with pictures of what was already out there in the counties available to the public. And the second goal, which was for this year, was to have at least 10% of those maps be actually digital so that the assessors could be using them in the course of their administration of the system, and folks could actually search data on the maps as well as just see pictures of them. The third and fourth goals move us to 50% digitization, 100% digitization by 2008, and an improvement in the accuracy of the maps. So the grants are starting to really roll in from the counties. They all have strategic business plans for how they're going to get to goal four, and we'd like to be able to continue to fund the grants that we know are going to come in this biennium. We're going to need some additional limitation in order to be able to do that. The dollars are in the fund. We just need the spending authority.
This is a mapping issue. I'd be happy to I'll be happy to make a motion that we approve the request. But I want to make certain as to where the funds are going, which counties, the list of counties. Now, I have a particular interest in this because this is based upon mapping and a base map system. It seems like to me that the largest counties ought to be receiving the largest grants. You're going to map the same amount of terra firma in a small county like Multnomah as you would in Mount here, another M county. I'm just anxious to know where those funds are going and to make sure that somehow they're getting out to those smaller counties like Multnomah and proportion if they go to Mount here based upon size.
Madam Chair, Representative Butler, I'm pleased to tell you that all the counties are participating in the grants. The counties in the metropolitan area, Multnomah and Washington particularly, are much farther down the road because the funds they've had available to apply, and so we're trying to make sure the dollars are going where they're needed the most with the counties that have less resource in order to do the work. So it is a redistribution of funds so that all of our counties will be able to have the same level of quality and accuracy in their maps and reach the goals at the same time.
Chair, I appreciate that, and I am anxious. But in all seriousness, you know, in those large, enormously large counties, where there is a tremendous amount of poverty and a lot of publicly held lands, it's really important, just as important for those folks to have this access to good, reliable data. I remember 6 years ago there was almost no possibility that we were ever going to get some of those rural counties involved in the programs. It just looked very remote, but now we are moving forward. I would like to, however, have a list of the county grants from the $1.5 million.
And you'll get those. Mm-hmm. Representative Miller.
Just for clarification, the funding mechanism for this is based on?
Square miles per county.
Oh, I'm sorry. I thought I read it was in the documents, the recording fees of $1 per document.
And then spread out.
And probably there's an equal amount from Malheur and Multnomah in terms of recording documents, wouldn't you guess? Okay. Well,
that's how they collect it. They distribute it based on miles.
I think you're going to come out all right, actually.
Any other questions?
I move the approval of the request.
Okay. You've heard the motion. Is there any other discussion? Any objection? So ordered.
Yeah, if you want me to.
Absolutely. No. Representative Miller will be carrying this one.
I want to carry my load.
That's right.
One out of 37.
There's one more left.
Well, yeah.
Are we sure you'd like to carry that one? Tell us.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, the next request is a request for an allocation out of the emergency fund to sustain the agency's operations through early on in the next calendar year. As you know, during the session, we provided general fund to the agency, which we took back a portion of because it was we expected to fund the operations with increased tobacco or cigarette tax and tobacco tax revenues. The anticipated tobacco tax receipts have not materialized. In fact, we're way under even the closing session forecast of what tobacco cigarette tax receipts would be. As a result, the department has come up short about $20 million. It has identified about $5 million in savings. It's been working on this since early on as it's been tracking these tax collections. And it still leaves it about $15-20 million short. $15 million after the savings. It has come forward with a request for $10 million from the emergency fund to help it get through at least through the session, where then it could come in for some supplemental funding request for the balance of this biennium.
Okay. Madam Chair, members of the committee, as Dallas has said, we have a shortfall in funding our income and property tax programs because of the fact that cigarette tax revenues have not come in even to meet the forecast. Just historically, what happened during the session, in I think it was August of 2003, we were asked whether we could generate additional revenue if there was an additional investment made in the task force that was assembled in 2001 between the Department of Revenue, the State Police, and the Department of Justice. We did kind of a quick review of what we knew at the time about where cigarette tax revenues were going. We had seen declines for several biennia, and in the 2001-03 biennium, we saw not only the decline stop, but we started to see an uptick in collections. And we had made quite an effort in that first task force that was put together by the 2001 legislature to get out and really make sure that our wholesalers and our retailers within the state of Oregon were marketing cigarettes on which the Oregon stamp existed and on which the Oregon tax had been paid. So we came back with an estimate that we thought, based on that information, if there was a significantly increased investment of about $4.8 million, I think, in the task force, that we thought we could generate an additional $30 million in taxes, both between the cigarette and the other tobacco products taxes, over the course of the biennium. The legislature said, okay, fund that task force, the $4.8 million, out of a portion of that increase And then fund general operations, income tax program and property tax program out of about $25 million. We've been out there. We've been talking to retailers. We've identified about 5,000 and have visited probably 95% of them. There's a very high level of compliance, much more than we had seen in 2002 when the first task force first got out into the field. And we're confident that our retailers and our wholesalers, for the most part, are selling cigarettes that are taxed and stamped under Oregon law. But we're also seeing what we believe is a fairly significant shift in the behavior of consumers. We've been working with the Department of Human Services to try to figure out what the consumption patterns are and what kind of changes are taking place, and it appears that there's a combination of reduction in consumption by smokers, whether it's by people just quitting altogether or cutting back on the number of cigarettes that they buy and smoke. We're also seeing a move in purchasing habits from retail stores in Oregon to the Internet, and many, many of the Internet websites that offer cigarettes for sale do not collect any state or federal taxes and obviously do not remit them to the states or the federal government. So we've run into those very different situations than what we saw in 2001 to 2003. We were given permission by the legislature to use up to $10 million of a collection in the other tobacco tax program to fund our general operations. We believe that the $10 million will come in. We still are seeing a pretty substantial amount of compliance issues on that side of the ledger, and we've got auditors and law enforcement work going on there, and so we believe we will make that part of the forecast. But on the cigarette side, we're projected now, I think Dallas just mentioned that the forecast has been reduced by $25 million. So we will not be permitted to spend any of the cigarette tax revenues that come in, because we were limited to whatever came in above the May forecast, the end of session forecast. So $5 million of that other tobacco products tax money will offset part of that 25 of operations. We have reduced our spending, curtailed our spending by about $5 million. Once we saw the beginning of the downward trend again in cigarette tax collections in April, May of this year, worked with DAS staff and talked to LFO about what was happening and started to curtail spending. But because of the proportion of our general fund that had been switched out, it was about 19%, we're not going to be able to make it all up by spending reductions without putting at risk our income tax production. During the 2003 legislature, we made a commitment to you that on the income tax side, we would generate an additional $20 million in the personal income tax and corporate income tax through increased compliance efforts. I'm very pleased to be able to tell you that money is in the bank, and that the continuing work by the additional staff will generate additional revenue between now and the end of the biennium. But we do have an operational problem, and it's $15 million. We were advised by Mr. Rocco and Dallas that the e-fund right now probably couldn't absorb a $10 million payment to us right away, and that the recommendation would be $5 million. And that we should come back in January to the emergency board. We're prepared to do that. I think we can make that work. When we do come back, I intend to have for you identified any additional savings in our budget that we can find to keep trying to make that hole smaller. Clear plan for where it is we're going to go with tobacco compliance efforts, recognizing these new issues that are very different from what we saw during the startup of the original task force. And we're going to continue to explore any other funding options that we can find to help get us through the remainder of the biennium. And I'd be happy to take questions.
Questions? No? Representative Miller.
refresh me on the number of additional agents, if any, that were put on to go collect the cigarette taxes that we thought were being avoided?
Madam Chair, Representative Miller, the plan was that we would add in the Revenue Department 17 additional staff to really get out and saturate the retail and wholesale market to assure that the inventory that was out there had been taxed and was properly stamped. The manner in which the taxes are collected is very different from our income tax programs. The wholesalers, who are the first distributors of cigarettes in the state, are required to purchase stamps from us and put those stamps on the packs of cigarettes. And they pay the tax through that stamp purchase. Then the product goes out into the retail market, and we verify through visiting the retailers and inspecting their inventory that they are, in fact, selling product that has been stamped. So we don't do collection in the field except for if we find unstamped product, and we have the ability now, because of legislation that was passed last legislative session, to impose civil penalties for failure to produce either records of payment of the tax for other tobacco products or having stamped cigarettes in the inventory. We have the ability to issue civil penalties at the retailer or at the wholesaler level. There's been some of that. The law enforcement component of the task force pursues criminal penalties, and there have been some fines proposed on that side as well. So there are dollars that come in from a little bit more directly from activity by the members of the task force, but the big, big revenue stream is through the stamp sales.
What I'm trying to get a handle on here is the one is we spent some additional funds expecting to collect more money, and that didn't happen. I guess I'm struck by the fact that we want to spend more money on a program that it's like rewarding us for failure by dipping in and getting additional funds. I realize it's you thought there'd be some more money in the till to pay for other things, perhaps, but that didn't happen. And so I'm, you know what I'm saying, Dallas? Here, and I guess the other thing that you've discovered is that compliance levels were rather high. And so what I need to do is understand how many people in your department are almost exclusively into this compliance with respect to cigarette tax. If there's a unit over there, not that if we got rid of all of them, we would still expect people to comply 100%. But maybe if we've discovered there isn't a huge problem out there, having this great force ready to leap into action when there's nothing to fight, maybe we can do without some of them.
Madam Chair, Representative Miller, you are anticipating the analysis that we're going to be doing over the next several weeks and bringing back to the January e-board. The number of people who are working on tobacco tax compliance, both cigarette and other tobacco products, is a separate unit within the department. The dollars that I'm asking for today are to fund the income tax program. And that is because our general fund budget that was approved in the normal budget process was right around $130 million of general fund for the biennium. When we came in and talked about augmenting the task force and generating additional revenue, the decision was made to take $25 million of our other general fund appropriation out of our budget and use it in other places where general fund was needed, and tell us
this would come in and take care of the shortfall.
Yeah, that was the idea, was that when this came in, it would backfill behind in programs that have historically been funded 100% general fund. So that's the problem that we face, is it's our general fund programs that are now at risk because the tobacco dollars didn't come in. The augmented task force, the total cost for the biennium of the augmented task force, our people additional state police detectives and additional folks at the Department of Justice was $4.8 million. And so it's the other $25.2 that would have gone into our income tax and property tax program administration that we don't have. And although the other tobacco products looks like we'll be able to use some of that, and then our, you know, our spending reductions brings that hole down in those programs to the 15 million.
I appreciate that.
I may add,
certainly.
Madam Chairman, Representative Miller, I think that one of the things you're asking about is this additional task force isn't paying, reaping the dividends we expected. Do we expect to scale back those activities in the upcoming biennium? I think we have talked, and I think believe budget management and I, we've talked, we believe that would be a reasonable thing to do. And this is what I believe Ms. Harshenko was talking about when the new plan, reassessing then the bang for the buck and maybe scaling down the size of the compliance efforts in the upcoming biennium.
Well, what's become apparent this morning is that the gamblers and the drinkers are doing their part, but the smokers are slacking.
I'm in the former, so not the latter.
Madam Chair,
Representative Butler,
I'm anxious about this whole process, and of course it starts with the movement of $25 million of general fund out of the department in exchange for raising cigarette tax money. And I know that Director Harshenko was uncomfortable with the concept right up front. I just want to voice a modicum of concern over the fact that we've got to be very careful about giving an agency penalty money to run a division. That I think that's probably a very bad turn to take on the road of managing any government department, and particularly a revenue department. And the second issue is, I would hope that Director Harshenko has enough authority that when she sees that the tobacco busts aren't out there that we had originally anticipated. I think that the co-chair called them the butt rangers, as I recall. If they're not out there, that the director would go ahead and, by her own initiative, at least as to the Department of Revenue, start to scale some of those folks back.
Madam Chair, Representative Butler, we've already started that process. We've looked really carefully at the information that we have about where our problems are today, how different they are from 2 years ago, and what kind of skill sets and numbers of people are needed to try to attack those problems. And in the discussion we had yesterday, I suggested that we'd be delighted to sit down and talk to you about where that's going, so that that you're comfortable that we're moving in a direction that is consistent with the compliance problems that we're seeing today.
Madam Chair, if I may,
yes,
as comfortable as I may be, I don't know that you're going to bring the Speaker and the President along quite that far, so that's why I say it's really important to get a good handle around those expenses ASAP and then move forward, because I'm not sure that we can find another $5 million next T-Board. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Butler.
Any other questions? Okay. Representative Butler moves approval of the LFO recommendation of $5 million from the emergency fund. Is there any discussion or objection? So ordered. Representative Miller's going to carry this one. Hey.
Thank you. Understand it.
And with that, we're adjourned.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, we hit the end.